Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Advisory Committee meeting. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one to ask your question. I would like to inform all participants that your conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to your conference host, Mr. Gustavo Sano. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Catherine, and welcome everyone. A quick announcement we have sent out via the listserv, and ME Action has posted on their Facebook page a new link. Our apologies, but we're using a new link from the one we used yesterday. The operator made an announcement, so if you're having any problem or if you cannot find the link, please, and if you are on the listserv, on the ZipSack listserv, just send us an email and we will send you the correct link for those listening in the public. We have for today, Chair Faith Newton, Dr. Newton, and Dr. Levine will be joining us in a few minutes. She's running a few minutes behind, but we have updates from NIH, from HRSA, from HARQ, and then from the Department of VA Affairs. And then we will hear from Gary Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan, a member of the committee, has been working with some other members of the community and members of the committee on medical education. Then we'll take a break. We'll just come back and discuss some recommendations based on Dr. Kaplan's work and with his committee. And then we'll discuss ZipSack SOP moving forward to be approved by the entire committee. At this point, I'd like to conduct a quick roll call. Sue Levine, since you will be late. Faith Newton.
Here.
Dane Cook.
Here.
Dr. Kaplan. I think he will be joining later. Alisa Cox. Alisa, if you are listening in the public, can you please dial star zero to get the operator so she can pull you as a speaker? Jose Montoya? Donna?
Yes.
Ted from HARQ? Beth and Hermes from CDC?
Beth is here.
Hermes is here.
Janet Maynard?
Here.
Joel Nerso?
Here.
Michelle Schaefer?
I'm here.
Vicki Whittemore, NIH?
Here.
And Drew Helmer from the VA?
Present.
Our non-boarding liaison, Leo Williams from Massachusetts, MEFN Association.
I'm here.
Courtney Williams, Cimarron Research?
I'm here.
Ben Surberger from ME Action?
I'm here.
Welcome, everyone. Faith, is Carmen going to join us today or not?
No, she's unavailable today.
Okay. Well, I'm turning it over to you for any opening remarks. Otherwise, we can go directly into the agency update.
I am looking forward to listening to the presentation. I think we've got an exciting afternoon planned. Why don't we start with the agency updates? I think we have, starting with NIH.
Can we start with the VA? Vicki, if you don't mind, with... No, he doesn't have slides.
Sorry, it was muted. Yes, that's fine with me. No problem.
So Drew, if you don't mind going first, because he has other commitments.
Thank you, Vicki.
Drew, you might be on mute. Drew? Oh, well. I'm sorry, Vicki. I guess you're back on. he emailed me early and said if he could go first, and I say okay, but now he's not, doesn't seem to be on. So we can start with NIH, if you don't mind.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. So thank you, everyone, and it's my pleasure to join and give you an update from NIH today. Next slide, please. So to start with, I would like to bring your attention to the funding from NIH for MECFS research. The fiscal year 16 data was recently released, and you can see that we're inching up toward $8 million in fiscal year 16, and hopefully with the funding of the new centers and the Data Coordinating Center, we'll certainly break that and hopefully break records, right, and keep on this upward trend. In the next slide, I would like to bring your attention also to the fact that we recently, NINDS, recently funded a new fellow. So this is Rakib Raihan, who works with James Baraniuk at Georgetown and at Howard University. He's an MD PhD student who recently received a fellowship award to study the neural correlates of fatigue in ME/CFS. So his funding will start this fall and will continue through August of 2021. So we're very excited about this opportunity to fund a new young investigator. Next slide. So just to remind you that NIH is open for business and open to receive grant applications at all times from investigators. So if you a way to see and to search any funding opportunity announcements, you can go to that website link on our NIH website. There are what we call parent announcements, and these are the standing grant announcements for all of the mechanisms. So this includes the R series of grants, which are investigator-initiated R grants, like the R01 and R21 and R03. For the F series, those are fellowship awards for undergrad, graduate, and postdoctoral fellows. And then there's the K series, which are primarily used for clinician scientists. And all of those parent announcements can be found on the website. If any of the investigators have questions about any of the mechanisms, they can contact me or the appropriate person from the appropriate institute who's a member of the Trans-NIH Working Group, or if you can't figure out who to contact, they can contact me and I can point them in the right direction. There, I would also like to announce that there will be coming out a new funding opportunity to specifically look at dynamic neuroimmune interactions in the transition from brain function to dysfunction. And this is going to be released by the NIAA Institute, the Alcohol and Alcoholism Institute, but with sign-on from all of the neuroscience and institutes, including NINDS, as well as, I believe, NIAID, to really look at what is happening in the brain in when the neuroimmune system goes awry. And so I think this could potentially be a mechanism for investigators studying ME/CFS who are interested in this aspect of the disease. And in the next slide. In terms of, I was asked to address what we see as future funding potential for ME/CFS, and many of you know, for fiscal year appropriations for fiscal year 17, which we received at the end of April, so this is funding that will take us through the end of September, we actually received an increase of funding. So NIH received a total of $34.1 billion, which includes over $300 million for the 21st Century Cures Act. And of that, you can see NINDS received $1.8 billion. The president's budget, as we are all aware, is calling for significant reductions in the NIH budget, so a $7.2 billion decrease overall for fiscal year 18. But what we are very uncertain about what that budget will look like and when we will actually receive a budget, as has happened in many of the past years. What happens at the end of September is that we get a continuing resolution, which means we function at the same budget level as we did the previous year until the time a new budget is actually passed and signed for that fiscal year. So we really don't know, and I have to say it's causing great concern, and it's causing leadership across NIH to be very conservative about what we're funding, not knowing what our out years, meaning if we award a grant in this year, we pay that first year out of fiscal year 17 funds, but not knowing what the future holds, everyone's a bit concerned and nervous about that. We could be hopeful that we'll get an increase like we did in fiscal year 17, but we won't know that until we see the budget. And in the next slide. So as you all know, we've been operating as the Trans-NIH ME-CFS Working Group at NIH since October of 2015. Is that right? Yeah, I think so. And it continues to be chaired by Dr. Cora Schatz, and I'm working with him to coordinate the group. Again, we're still represented by 24 institutes, offices, and centers. We continue to meet monthly and have ongoing discussions in between those meetings. And rather than planning, we're now implementing our goals and strategies to stimulate and support research on ME-CFS. And in the next slide. So what have we accomplished? Well, in fiscal year 16, we were able to award 7 administrative supplement awards. And these are awards that were given, supplemental funds that were given to existing NIH-funded grants, 5 from NIAID and 2 to investigators funded by NINDS to supplement the work that they were doing either on ME-CFS or in one case, an administrative supplement went to Mark Davis at Stanford that's really allowed him to expand his research into looking at T-cell dysfunction in ME-CFS, and he's, I think, moving forward with what seem to be some really promising and interesting and exciting results. We've also used the request for information that was provided to help guide us and shape the research focus and priorities moving forward, and as you heard yesterday, together with the CDC, NIH is moving forward with a Common Data Elements project, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail now in the next slide. So NINDS started their Common Data Elements programs several years ago, and this is carried out with a contract. Currently, the contract is with EMIS. It's in the process of being recompeted at this time, but is a project that has now been carried out across many different neurological diseases, and several other institutes at NIH have also participated in their own Common Data Elements projects. And the goal of developing Common Data Elements is to provide standardized data collection so investigators can systematically collect, analyze, and share data. So the idea is that rather than one lab collecting and reporting out the outcomes of a specific test in one way and another lab doing it a different way, this allows for collection of those same elements in the same way so that data can be compared and in many cases pooled across different studies. So in the next slide, you can see that these are all of the subgroups that are working across all of these various domains of ME-CFS. So some of the folks on the call today and many of the investigators, both researchers, clinicians, and advocates are participating in this effort. And I have to say, I've been very impressed with the work that's carried on so far and the very thoughtful discussions and work that's being carried out. So in each of these areas, what they do is they begin by looking at what are the tests or instruments or measures that are utilized in this particular area, and come to some consensus on what they recommend as being those tests that would be most suited for research on ME/CFS. Then move to looking at, well, if this particular test is being used, then what are the outcome measures or data elements that would be collected, and how should those data elements be reported out? So we're moving forward with all of this, and in the next slide, this is the timeline. We pushed this out a little bit because we had a little bit of a lull in activity while everyone was busy writing their grant applications. And so we've now pushed this out such that we are hoping to have the first round of all of the common data elements ready to push out to the public for comment this fall, with them coming back and revising those and finalizing those common data elements in December timeframe, such that they can begin to be used in the new centers and in other NIH-funded research as well. There have been some discussions both within the individual, amongst the individuals who are participating on all of these subgroups, as well as outside of this, as to what is the role of the case definitions as we're moving forward in developing the common data elements. And what we started out this project being naive to case definition being used, but we're real, I think in some of the internal discussions we've been having at NIH, realizing that since this is such a huge issue and concern in the community, we're going to have to address this in terms of saying if you're using X case definition, which you should then utilize the following test instruments, and here's how we would request that the data be reported out. We see that this is something that is a discussion that needs to be had in the community, and something we will task the new collaborative centers and the data management coordinating center to lead in the discussion. This isn't something that we feel should be NIH telling the investigators this is what to do, but the investigators will come to a consensus once we bring everyone together this fall, once the centers are funded. So in the next slide, additional things that we've been involved in, I, together with my colleague, Andrea Breeden, attended the Invest in ME conference, both the colloquium, the scientific conference, and the day-long conference that's specifically developed for the lay community, patients and patient advocates, and other clinicians. And Sue reported out on some of the interesting findings from that conference. And I have to say, I think we came away from that conference very enthused about the research that's going on and the developing information that really is pointing toward various different subtypes of ME/CFS that may be based on whether the individual has dysfunction in B cells or T cells or another aspect of metabolism. And so I think that this is really exciting research that will really blossom within the next couple of years. We've also participated in sessions on ME/CFS at professional scientific conferences. So first at the SLEEP 2017 meeting, Joe Breen from NIAID and I were asked to be part of a session that was specifically focused on sleep, fatigue, and cytokines. Hans Knopp talked about ME/CFS directly, and the rest of the folks talked about various aspects of fatigue and cytokines, and Joe and I really filled in terms of what NIH's interest is in both ME/CFS and in general fatigue research going forward. That session was organized by Janet Mullington and David Raisin. We also Joe Breed and I also organized and had accepted a session at the Federation of Clinical Immunology Societies in Chicago. And in that session, Beth Unger gave a very nice overview of ME-CFS and was followed by Mark Davis, Eleanor Riley, Ian Lipton, and Jose Montoya talking about various research aspects specifically focused primarily on immunology. And I think although we were a bit disappointed by the numbers of people that came to the session, the people that came were very interested and were very motivated, I think, about excited about the research and where the research community is headed in ME-CFS. And the next slide. So one of the other things we've been working very hard on this year is to foster collaboration and communication regarding research activities on ME-CFS, both between federal agencies and nonprofit organizations, as well as with foreign funding agencies. So we've had discussions with the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. When I was in England, I recently met with representatives from the Medical Research Council in England, in the UK, and the National Institute of Health Research. And these folks are all very interested in supporting worldwide collaboration and open communication between researchers to really move the field forward as rapidly as possible. We were also recently contacted by the research funding agency in Australia and are beginning those conversations as well. And in the next slide, what was a major accomplishment for us and hopefully for the community was that we released the new funding announcements in January of this year. And these were two different announcements, one to develop multidisciplinary, multi-site collaborative research centers, and a second to fund a data management coordinating center. So this is a collaboration across NIH Institute's offices and centers where we will support $6 million per year for 5 years for ME-CFS research. And so we think this translates at least tentatively now to funding 2 to 3 centers, as well as the Data Management Coordinating Center. So our goal for these centers is to foster the use of common protocols and data elements across sites so that we can begin to look at larger cohorts of individuals with ME-CFS, to enable and support research at academic centers. As many of you know, many of the clinicians who see individuals with ME-CFS are in private practice or are not at academic centers. So we're pleased to see actually that many of them are involved and included in the applications. And so this is hopefully a way to bring that expertise into partnering with researchers in academic centers. And where possible, we hope that they can leverage the Clinical Science Translational Awards, which are awards that come out of NCATS, the National Center for Accelerating Translational Research at NIH. And these centers can help to provide them with significant amounts of infrastructure, help with IRB approvals, all kinds of sort of standard things that go on within an academic center that won't need to be copied over and duplicated in these centers, but can utilize the resources that are already there. We also hope that these centers will encourage the involvement of young and new investigators, both basic scientists, clinicians, clinician scientists. And one of the key pieces of the applications was that we required each applicant to include community engagement and involvement in their application such that they will be informed by the community and partner with the community in all aspects of their research going forward. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been in discussions with some of the other foreign funding agencies and looking at ways that we can partner and collaborate with them to expand this center and expand research with utilizing funding from each of those resources, but we're all working together to really address the goals of the centers. And in the next slide. So overall, our research interests include, but aren't limited to, determining the etiology and pathogenesis in ME/CFS, studies to help identify subtypes of ME/CFS based on biological markers or symptom classifications, longitudinal studies to understand the course of disease over time to better characterize the manifestations and develop and validate outcome measures for future intervention or clinical trials, and the identification of potential treatment targets for ME/CFS. And next slide, please. So our timeline here is that the announcements were released in January. We received letters of intent for those planning to submit applications in April. The full applications came in May. The applications will be reviewed in late July. And our funding recommendations will be reviewed at the appropriate NIH Institute Advisory Committees in September. And I put hopefully here, we will get the funding announcements out the door if everything aligns perfectly and we have no glitches. We should be able to fund the centers in September. You never know when somebody has a problem with getting IRB approval or there's some glitch, but our hope is that we will fund the centers and the data coordinating center in September and then have a sort of all hands on deck investigators meeting in early fall to bring them all together to really launch this new initiative. And then the next slide. Just quickly, the NIH intramural study, as many of you know, this study has now been ongoing, and actually my numbers are now out of date. They've brought in more than 5 healthy controls and study participants. They're coming in weekly or biweekly at this point. And so these people have now completed visit 1, which is the careful phenotyping, lots of studies that are being carried out. And those they will begin calling those individuals back for their second visit, which will be exercise testing and post-exertional malaise evaluation beginning in July, as they're also continuing to bring in the newer study participants. There's extensive analysis and biospecimen collection happening, and to date, everything has seemed to move along quite smoothly. And in the next slide, for those who know Brian, this is Brian Vastag, who has ME/CFS and recently came to NIH to participate in the study. So you see him in one picture there with Francis Collins, who went over to the clinical center to meet with Brian while he was there. And then in the other, you see Brian on the tilt table participating in that particular test. I met with Brian after he was through the protocol, and he was very positive about his experience there, a little exhausted, I think, but very positive nevertheless. So I think we are very appreciative of all the people that are participating from many different institutes to make this a successful study at the NIH Clinical Center. And in the next slide. The ME/CFS Special Interest Group continues to bring in outside speakers for their seminar series. And coming up in July, Ian Lipkin will be visiting NIH July 12th. And then Sonia Marshall-Gradnicnik and Don Staines from Australia will be visiting toward the end of July. And these opportunities really provide wonderful exchange of information, both in a sort of more seminar presentation format, and then the individuals spend time visiting with each of the appropriate individual investigators who are part of the clinical study. So it's been a very successful program, and many of the folks on my side in the extramural also attend these seminars to really hear what's going on and understand more about the clinical aspects that are being looked at in the clinical study. And the next slide. So our plans going forward. We have a stakeholder conference call coming up on July 10th. We're working, as I said, toward completing the CDE project toward the end of December, launching the collaborative centers and the data management coordinating center, and fostering collaboration and communication between foreign and U.S. agencies, as well as the nonprofit and advocacy organizations going forward. We are working toward a interagency collaborative group that will, we're hopeful could bring together those people specifically interested in research on ME/CFS, and the status of that is that that's currently being reviewed by Francis Collins's office, and as soon as possible, we'll be able to say more about that moving forward. And in the next slide. Our long-term goals haven't changed. We're still continuing to stimulate, support research, grow the pipeline of researchers and investigators, support and expand the collaborative researchers as funding becomes available, support development of new therapies and treatments, support clinical trials for ME/CFS, and ultimately to improve the quality of life for all individuals with ME/CFS. And the next slide. I'll stop there, and I don't know if you want to take questions now or wait until the end of the session, but here is the link for the ME/CFS website as well as my email address. And so please contact us or check out information on the website as you have the interest. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Vicki. We will take questions at the end, like we did yesterday after the agency updates.
Okay.
So we'll take questions from the committee at the end and then open the lines for the public. Drew, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. So if you want to go ahead and give your updates from the VA.
Yes, thank you, and I apologize for disappearing briefly there. So I have a very brief overview of the VA report. I think I'd like to start by saying the VA does not have a strong, explicit focus on ME/CFS, but actually considers it a distinct entity under an umbrella term that we use commonly in the VA called chronic multi-symptom illness, or CMI. We do have a little bit of data about the prevalence of ME/CFS, mostly from claims data from within the Veterans Health Administration. And I would say the summary of that experience as reported in the literature is that the prevalence of ME/CFS is a little lower among veterans than the general population. Now, these are not direct comparisons. But in some groups, particularly veterans who were deployed to Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm in 1990 and 91, also known as Gulf War veterans, the rate of ME/CFS or ME/CFS-like conditions is higher or equivalent to the general U.S. population. So the VA has focused to a large extent on that cohort that was deployed in 1990 to the Persian Gulf region and uses the term Gulf War illness or Gulf War veterans illnesses to differentiate this condition. Also, it's considered under this broader umbrella label of chronic multi-symptom illness. And obviously, there are some similarities to ME/CFS, but I think many people feel that it is not the same condition, or it is a subgroup of a broader group of diseases. Regardless, Gulf War illness is a very high priority for the VA, and this is expressed in kind of all three branches of the VA. We have our Benefits Administration, we have the Health Administration, which includes the research, but also the clinical care. So across benefits, clinical care, research, we see a high emphasis and a high priority for Gulf War illness in the VA. Some recent activities related to chronic multi-symptom illness within the VA include the development of a provider education video discussing a VA-DOD, an interagency clinical practice guideline for the management of chronic multi-symptom illness. The guideline itself was an update. It was completed in 2014, at the end of 2014, and was an update from an earlier clinical practice guideline on that was entitled Management of Medically Unexplained Physical Symptoms. But very recently, we actually completed an educational video for providers and a promotional video to disseminate the, you know, awareness or to increase awareness of the availability and the presence of this clinical practice guideline, as well as a frequently asked questions sheet. And so this toolkit to, you know, further disseminate the clinical practice guideline has been enhanced, and that is all being finalized and launched as we speak. In addition, the War-Related Illness and Injury Study Center, which focuses on medically unexplained conditions related to deployment, offers monthly webinars for providers within the VA system, and we're also developing on-demand online e-learning modules on both chronic multi-symptom illness generally and Gulf War illness more specifically. All of these activities are accredited for continuing education for various providers. Another important development, and I think this is going to be of interest, is that the VA Office of Research and Development is currently reviewing and updating its strategic plan for research related to Gulf War illness. The last time this was done was in 2015, and there is a federal advisory committee to the VA Secretary on Gulf War illness, and that committee has been engaged in with the Office of Research and Development in updating the research strategy. Finally, I think you know, maybe a little bit of an editorial comment. I think from where I sit in the War-Related Illness and Injury Study Center and as a clinician researcher very engaged in chronic multi-symptom illness care and research, I think we tend to take lead from other agencies, in particular the NIH, and, you know, I'll commend my colleague for that very thorough and illuminating presentation. And I think what we can do is take some of that information and start to apply it to both our research activities and our clinical care of patients within the VA. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to be an ex officio member of this committee. I would be happy to present a more detailed overview of the VA's activities related to CMI and Gulf War illness at the December meeting. I kind of put this out here today as a feeler to see if the committee thinks it would be of interest and relevant. And obviously it would be helpful to know whether some of the clinical and provider education activities would be of more interest or the research activities related to CMI and Gulf War illness. So I'm going to stop there, and I should be able to hear any questions, field any questions, or hear any comments at the end of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. I'm sure we'll hear from members of the public as to whether or not they want you to do that presentation in December. And we're also interested to hear how many of them are actually veterans and receiving care through the VA after we're done with all the presentations. So moving on to HRSA. Commander Nelson.
Good afternoon, Gustavo. Good afternoon, Gustavo. Thank you, and good afternoon to the group. I really appreciate the opportunity to present this afternoon, to provide a couple of updates from the last meeting from HRSA, but also essentially based on a recent meeting, I had the opportunity to meet with Carol Head and Emily Taylor from the Solve ME CFS initiative. And based on that meeting, it occurred to me that it would probably be helpful to give this group a general overview of HRSA and the work that we do to help sort of inform the recommendations that you make for the Secretary in the context of the work that we do at HRSA as a part of the Department of Health and Human Services. So I wanted to spend, if we could go to the next slide, please, just spend a little bit of time talking about broadly about the work that we do, give some examples of the impact of our work, and highlight some maybe opportunities where you all might find room to align a recommendation with our focus. So the Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, as I mentioned, is an agency within the Department of Health and Human Services, and we support grant programs, over 90 programs actually, that provide healthcare to people who are geographically isolated or economically or medically vulnerable. So essentially the bottom line is our focus really is on that geographically isolated, in other words, rural communities and populations, and the underserved. And we do that through, as I mentioned, grants, cooperative agreements, and contracts that we award through funding opportunity announcements, which are derived from authorizing statute, legislation such as the Public Health Service Act, as it relates then to the Ryan White CARE Act for HIV/AIDS programs, and the Social Security Act. Those documents, those statutes really inform the work that we do, and Congress then appropriates our programs in order to execute those missions. Every year we serve millions of people, including those special populations such as those with HIV/AIDS, pregnant women, mothers, and their families and children, and others who otherwise have challenges essentially accessing healthcare. Next slide, please. With a few legislatively based exceptions, such as the National Hansen's Disease Program and the Ryan White HIV/AIDS Program, our focus really is more on a macro or global level with respect to access to care and services and related services. And our work is organized essentially into these five overarching areas, which are increasing access to high-quality healthcare and health services, strengthening the health workforce, both by adding new members to that workforce, but also training current providers, making sure that they are well-trained, especially in work with rural and underserved populations. Third, focusing on building healthy communities. And fourth, reducing health disparities and thus improving health equity. And then finally, focusing on the proper management of our programs, strengthening program operations, ensuring alignment with our authorizing statutes and any additional guidance that we receive from Congress, monitoring the performance of our award recipients and providing technical assistance to ensure we maximize the impact of that investment, and then, of course, trying to reduce the burden on those grantees. So if we go to the next slide, we'll sort of unpack these agency goals and talk about some of the component programs and the impact of those programs. So under Goal 1, increasing access to care, essentially we focus on, as I mentioned, rural, underserved populations. And so I think it's interesting to highlight that 1 in 13 people nationwide utilize HRSA-funded health centers. You may be familiar with the term federally qualified health centers. 1 in 13 people within the country rely on health center services for preventive and primary care needs. When you dig deeper, 1 in 3 people living at or below the poverty level utilizes the services provided by health centers for their primary medical care. Over 50% of people diagnosed with HIV receive care through the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, which is a comprehensive system of care which was first enacted in 1990. And 10 million people living in health professional shortage areas receive primary care, dental, or mental health care through the National Health Service Corps program. Yesterday, Leah mentioned that she coordinates her activities within Massachusetts, and that she had interacted with our Office of Regional Operations. And I think that's a good point to highlight that there are, while you know we are obviously based out of Washington, D.C., there are plenty of opportunities within the region, more locally based, for engagement with our offices. And so I would encourage folks to engage at that level as well. Next slide. Half of pregnant women and one-third of infants and children benefit from the Title V block grant under our Maternal and Child Health Bureau. And MCHB also focuses on their home visiting program. You see a little further down the slide that nearly 150,000 parents and children participate in that program. We have the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, which focuses on access to care in rural communities, and nearly 14 million rural Americans receive health services from a HRSA-funded provider in those rural communities. So again, ensuring that those communities have access to not only a healthcare facility, but also to well-trained providers familiar with their needs. We do, within our health systems bureau, operate a division of transplantation. If you're interested for more information on that, you can visit organdonor.gov. But we facilitated about 30,000 organ transplants, including 6,000 blood stem cell transplants last year. So some really interesting work happening there. Next slide. With respect to the health workforce, HRSA trains medical, dental, mental, and behavioral health providers through the National Health Service Corps and the Nurse Corps programs. This is one area where it's really sort of one of our flagship programs. And we trained about 11,000 students, residents, and health providers through the National Health Service Corps Scholarships Program last year, specifically focusing some of those on integrative health, where there's certainly a nexus with ME/CFS. Further, we support through Title VII and Title VIII. Those are Titles VII and VIII within the Public Health Service Act. That's the authorizing statute for various programs in interprofessional care, mental and behavioral health, programs that focus on increasing the workforce diversity. So programs, some of them by name, the Regional Public Health Training Center Program, Primary Care Training and Enhancement Program, the Nursing Workforce Diversity Program. As mentioned, over 90 programs funded through HRSA, but many of them are focused specifically on training health professions, training health professionals specifically for work with rural and underserved populations. Next slide. We support a National Center for Interprofessional Practice and Education really focus on a priority of training multidisciplinary teams, so multiple provider types all working together to deliver high-quality care. We supported primary care training residencies, primary care residency programs, approximately 60 locations for those, last year trained over 550 residents. Further, we also focus on training mental health providers, clearly there's a huge focus currently on the opioid crisis, and last year we trained almost 6,000 new mental health providers. With respect to training for clinicians, I do know that at the last meeting there was a question regarding an ME/CFS handout that was produced by a HRSA grantee, and did want to provide the update that we circled back with the National Center for Integrative Primary Care, and wanted to update this group that that draft document is currently being updated based on feedback received, and the contractor has worked with the CDC to sort of refine some of that material. They hope to have a draft ready by the end of July, at which point I know they're already actually in touch with Gustavo, but they will circle back at that point to connect with this group and to receive any final feedback on that. Of course, it will likely be a living document, but really appreciate the input and the opportunity to take that back and to make some refinements to that program. Next slide. HRSA also focuses on building healthy communities, and I mentioned our Office of Rural Health Policy, which focuses on access to care for rural populations, which includes the viability of rural hospitals. A huge part of what that office does is to coordinate healthcare activities for the approximately 60 million Americans who live in rural areas. They also support other types of initiatives which help increase access to care, such as telehealth, telemedicine, and other health IT initiatives. The last line there, a little bit more with respect to our Maternal and Child Health Bureau's work focused on perinatal health outcomes and trying to reduce disparities between racial and ethnic groups by using community-based service delivery. Next slide. Goal four, as mentioned, and sort of echoing the last bullet point from the previous slide, is to reduce health disparities. HRSA does that by providing enabling services, such as housing, food services, nutrition counseling, job support, to over 2 million patients nationwide. And I mentioned the HIV-AIDS Bureau, the Ryan White HIV-AIDS program focuses, among its many programs, of course, on outcomes related to viral suppression and have improved those rates from 70 to 79% since just 2010. And another example of ways to reduce health disparities through the 340B drug pricing program. 340B is a reference to the section of that authorizing statute. Through that program, they saved qualified safety net organizations approximately $5 billion annually, negotiating reduced prescription rates for safety net provider organizations. And on the next slide, this is just a sort of an overview of the various components of our organization. HRSA is run by an administrator. Dr. George Sagunas actually just recently arrived about 2 months ago and sends his regards. You can see then around the rest, the perimeter of this slide, the other offices and bureaus that do the work that I just described. And so hopefully this has been helpful to sort of set the stage for the type of work that HRSA does through our statute, through our sort of legislatively derived program. But there are certainly areas where our mission overlaps with your work in ME/CFS. And I think just a few things I would highlight is to say that nonprofit entities are eligible to apply for our funding opportunities. And so if you are not already signed up at grants.gov, any nonprofit organization can come in for most of our announcements. And that's a great way to track new opportunities. And although they may not explicitly state ME/CFS as the focus, as I mentioned, most of our work is more on a global access to care or health workforce development level. Certainly, as a vulnerable or medically underserved community, I think there are ways to make the case to tie that into the overall mission or even to partner with a prospective applicant, such as an academic institution or another healthcare facility, to that end. And we will continue to work on ME/CFS awareness and training initiatives for all of our workforce development programs, I think, as much as we can, and that provider education material will really be key in doing that. If you go to the next slide, you can see my contact information there, and I'm happy to serve as the nexus back to HRSA, although we mostly work through Gustavo here. But at the bottom of that slide, you can see some resources. If you want to get more information about our programs, you can visit our website at HRSA.gov. Follow us on Twitter, of course, or through Facebook. And those resources can help to link you to other pages such as grants.gov that I mentioned or organdonor.gov. So with that, I'll pause and I guess defer for questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Commander Nelson.
Ted, are you on? I guess not. He emailed me and told me he was going to be on and off. And I'm not sure if he has any update from HARQ. So let's, Faith, turn it over to the rest of the committee to ask questions of either Vicky, Drew, or Joel.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Well, folks are coming up with their questions. I wanted to comment on Vicky's presentation. I thought it was very thorough and very well done. I was really excited to hear about the Common Data Elements Project and the work that you're doing.
To ask a question by phone, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone.
The multidisciplinary, multi-site collaborative research centers, that also looks very exciting as well. So I think you've done a lot with what you're doing, and just wanted to commend you on the presentation and the collaboration with the other agencies, with CDC, et cetera, with Beth Unger, and all of that. I thought it was well done. Questions from other SIF staff members?
This is Courtney Miller. I have a comment and a question for Dr. Whittemore. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Dr. Whittemore, I wanted to thank you for your work. Thank you for the detailed presentation. And I know I haven't been on this body before, so I wanted to take the opportunity to say that having watched NIH presentations over probably 15 years on CIFSEC, certainly the last year of presentations and today's have been far more substantive than anything in my memory. So I want to thank you for your work on that, Dr. Koroshev, Dr. Collins, for shifting the program. And I want to thank Dr. Koroshev for the comment he made at, I think it was at NIH Advisory Council meeting, acknowledging that this is a start and we probably need 10 to 20 times the current funding levels to adequately address ME/CFS in the research field. And his comment was in response to Dr. Lipkin raising the dollar amount from the recent RFAs. And as you know, we support, my husband and I have supported, Cimarron supports the center grants, the request for applications, the intramural study, the initiatives that have been taken. But we also want to recognize that the funding levels, even with those grants, need to increase to be as productive as we need. And my question really goes to something I raised yesterday with Dr. Maynard and the FDA presentation. How can NIH and FDA work together on a plan to move forward an initiative to do clinical trials in ME/CFS? It is the third leg of the stool. We're in a chicken and egg situation. There's never enough research to identify new treatments, and there's never a study of existing treatments to figure out what's working for whom. And there's a considerable amount that can be learned on the question of subsets about who responds to particular kinds of treatments, even on a small scale. And so I really want to figure out, and I'd like to hear a thoughtful plan put together that is that has our federal agencies really moving forward a clinical trial program, feeding it in the way you're doing with the RFAs for the clinical centers, the collaborative centers. We need to change the current cycle, which has left patients without treatments for 30 years. So I, my question is to Dr. Whittemore. I also want to ask the chairs, the co-chairs of CIFSEC, how do we participate in putting forward a real program that has the potential to create clinical trials and treatment options for patients?
So, sure. I'm not muted, I don't think.
No, you're on.
Okay, thank you. So thank you, Courtney, first of all, for your comments and for your question. So I would, I think, echo or repeat what I said yesterday in that in discussing potential clinical trials with investigators and with program staff at NIH, what seems to be the missing piece at this point in time is how is there a way that we can better predict who would respond to a particular treatment so that we're not enrolling individuals into trials that may in fact be harmful to them. So I have long discussions with this with the folks from Norway. And if you look at the data, the preliminary data that they've released, and they tell me that this is looks to be the same in the blinded study, although they don't, of course, at this point know who's getting drug and who's getting placebo. But there are certainly people who are responders, who respond very well, very consistently, continue to have a good response to the treatment. There are people who show no response whatsoever, so either those are non-responders or people who are getting placebo. And then there are a lot of people in the middle. And so what we feel would be helpful would be to eventually get to the point where you have a person that would come in and we would be able to identify the underlying cause or causes of their ME/CFS such that they would then be put into the appropriate clinical trial so that we have sort of a battery of trials ongoing or treatment interventions that could be tested in the population. And so one of the things that was very clear to us when we began to look at what to put in place, which led to the RFAs for the collaborative centers, is that most of the treating clinicians are not at academic sites. It would be best for NIH to fund clinical trials through academic centers. So we needed to put this initial infrastructure in place that can lead then to future clinical trials. And again, as I said yesterday, we don't see this as 5 years of the centers before we even begin to think about clinical trials, but putting this infrastructure in place that will lead to clinical trials and lead to investigators being able to come together to think about the best way forward to present these clinical trials and provide and submit the applications to NIH. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll see if you have comments back to me about this, but I think the other thing that will be important is what the CDC and FDA have been working on, which are the outcome measures, so that we have very clear outcome measures so that when a clinical trial is done, we know what the objective outcome measures will be that will tell us if the trial is successful or not, and what those meaningful outcomes for patient function and health are that can be utilized in those trials. So I think what they're doing is also critically important. And all of these pieces hopefully will be coming together in the next year to two that will really help to boost our ability to do clinical trials in this area.
Thank you, Vicki. Do you have a follow-up, Courtney?
That we have to start what we have. We do have certain treatments being used by certain clinicians, and we could have data on who's responding. It's your point about the rituximab trial in Norway. But we have to figure out, we can't really wait until we identify the underlying cause for five different subsets. So we do have a place we could be starting. The importance of the outcome measures goes back to the question of who's engaged in producing those.
Who
is engaged?
I missed a word.
In, coming up with those. It's great that we're using data from the clinicians who know the disease the most, but they have to be part of that process. And so I think if we do have the ingredients that come together over the next year, we should figure out now how do we inform that plan and how do we lay it out so that people have targets to, whether it's investigators or drug makers, to start looking at our disease. So I guess from the CIFSAC perspective, you know, can we consider when we come to the end of the meeting or our agendas for the next meeting, you know, working group to put some real substance into making a plan. I don't think if we don't start making the plan this year, it won't happen for 2 to 3 more years. And we have to do something to attract study and investment by the pharmaceutical companies who have shunned this disease. I'll leave it at that.
I understand what you're asking, and the question that I am going to want to have an answer from the rest of the members on this committee, as well as the ex officios, is we don't want to put together a recommendation or a plan that has no, that will not be funded. So this, and that's what's happened in the past, where there have been recommendations that have been made that either are not realistic or that have no, that there's no possibility of them being funded. So I think what we're trying to do is change how CIFSAC works, and that we are all starting to work together with all the ex officios and the different agencies to see what is realistic and what can we move forward. So I don't have an answer to that question, but I think that as we start, you know, with all of us figuring out how to move forward, I think that we will get there, but I want to hear from the ex officios as well as to, is that realistic to start a working group on that to move forward too quickly, too fast? And I don't know.
Vicki.
Go ahead, Vicki.
So, you know, I'm saying this as an ex officio, and I guess I would like to hear from the committee and other ex officios, but it's not clear to me that that's really the purview of CIFSAC. I think, and other ex officios, please chime in, that as I said, NIH is open to talking to investigators about funding clinical trials. We don't have set aside money for any clinical trial. Any investigator or group of investigators can come in and submit grants for review for clinical trials. In my mind, what is needed are these clear outcome measures, plus looking at and bringing in potentially, and again, I don't see this as a purview of CIFSAC, but maybe a purview of us federal agencies, to bring in people from the pharmaceutical company and say, were you to look at a clinical trial in this area, what's missing? What would encourage you to participate or and even fund a clinical trial for ME/CFS? And to really, I mean, if that is, I think, the plan you're talking about, Courtney, I think that's certainly something that we could engage in and we could certainly do to better understand what those pieces are that would both make it more feasible for NIH to fund clinical trials and make it more attractive for pharmaceutical companies to be interested in supporting clinical trials.
Thank you. Other comments from other members of CIFSAC?
Hi, this is Ben Suborger. I have a two questions for Dr. Whitmore. One's just a small one about the thank you very much. It was a very substantive presentation. I really appreciated all the information you provided. On the second slide, just a small formatting thing. When I reviewed this, the NIH funding slide in advance, I had a little trouble putting together the information that you provide in that slide with what I was aware of some of the funding. So it would be helpful maybe in addition to the bar graph lines if you put totals for each year so we could, so I could be more clear on that. So that's just a smaller technical thing. And I think the larger question that I had, of course, you know, as MEACTION and the patient community, I think in general, is also very concerned about the budget cuts or the future budgets for agencies and what that means for our work going forward. But I guess the main thing, the key question I have is how do we get MECFS to get a fair share of whatever budget is available? I recognize there's a lot of uncertainty around what budgets are going to be, but given that historically in the past, MECFS has not had a share of funding commensurate with its disease burden, and I think still everyone would recognize that the funding is still not commensurate with disease burden, you know, it's not reasonable to ask this community to wait, you know, for answers about that until, you know, future times that budgets are going to slow down. So what I'd like to hear are what assurances can you give and what steps are being taken at the NIH level to assure that whatever the pie is that you're dealing with, that MECFS gets a fair and commensurate share of that funding. I know there's been some incremental increases, but what are we going to do to change that situation so that there is the funding that's commensurate, even if the pie isn't as big as what we would all like? Thank you.
Sorry, Vicky, this is Gustavo. Before you reply, I got an email from a note taker, and she reminded me to please say your name before you speak for the sake of the minutes. Thank you.
Okay, this is Vicki Whitmore. Sorry,
I was just going to say, with Ben Zubor at MEACTION.
Oh, thank you first for the formatting comment. I will take that under, I will make sure to do that better next time, so thank you for that comment. So it's difficult, right? So we, at NIH, unless Congress directly tells NIH and appropriates funds for a certain amount of dollars for a certain disease, all other diseases are essentially put into and research areas, not even diseases, basic research and translational research is funded out of general funds based on the scores that grants obtain in grant review. So I think what my observation has been, if you look back historically, there were people doing research on MECFS that fell by the wayside, either because they lost interest and or couldn't get their research funded, whatever the reasons were. And I was very encouraged by the response we got to the RFAs for the centers and the number of people that expressed great excitement about this, as well as people from outside the field who said, this is an area I do something related. Perhaps I could move into doing research on MECFS because NIH clearly has an interest in this area. So the way we're thinking about it is that, as Dr. Collins said at the Director's Advisory Council meeting, we see this investment that we're making now in the centers and the research we're currently funding through investigator-initiated grants as just the beginning. And as more is known, as we bring more investigators into the field, the the part of the pie that goes to ME/CFS will just expand. And it's our job as people at NIH to really help foster research and to help investigators to put in the best applications as possible. And so, you know, I think that is probably how I can best answer your question at this point. And if you look historically at other diseases that started out with very little funding, very few people, as soon as sort of a critical mass of research starting to happen, things exploded. And I think that's sort of where I see that ME/CFS research is just at the cusp of this hopefully explosion of bringing new interest, new people, increased grant application numbers of applications and funds to this research area. So, you know, I wish that we could say we want this part of the pie dedicated toward ME/CFS, but especially with the uncertainty of the budgets, the number of really directed initiatives is really decreasing at NIH because we're leaving the open to investigator-initiated research.
Thank you, Vicki. Are there questions for any of the presenters, the ex officio members?
This is Donna. Can I ask a couple questions of Janet, our FDA ex officio?
Go ahead, Donna.
Okay. Number one, we know that the rituximab trial results will be published, hopefully in the near future. If and when the results show that, yes, there is a subset of patients who respond, what is the process for the FDA to then approve that drug in the United States for use for this specific disease? My understanding, it is approved for use already, but not for this disease. And then my second question, I'll just throw it out there, is the one and only drug that we know about that's tried to get approval specifically for this disease, of course, is Ampligen. And it was reviewed by the FDA in 2012. And that was before the FDA did the voice of the patient and gleaned a whole heck of a lot of knowledge about it. And it was before the IOM, and it was before the P2P. And I think most people would agree that if the FDA had the information about how devastating the disease is, it is likely that that drug would have been approved, because we've seen so many other drugs being approved for other conditions like multiple sclerosis, where they believe that the quality of life is so horrible, they even take more risky drugs and give them approval, whereas this disease was found to be relatively safe. So my second question is, is there any kind of a mechanism where the FDA, having new information about a disease, takes a drug that has previously been denied, looks at that same information, and is able to consider approving it without the need to go through, you know, multi-million-dollar trials moving forward, in other words?
Hi, and this is Janet Maynard from FDA. So I guess I can give a general response that can hopefully address both questions and then maybe dive into both separate questions. So both of your questions are essentially, how can we get a drug approved, be that rituximab or Ampligen or really any drug, to help the patients who are suffering with ME/CFS, correct? That's your question.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So the way it would work for either rituximab or Ampligen or any pharmaceutical company that wanted to seek approval of their drug for ME/CFS, what they would do is they would submit information to FDA. Generally, how pharmaceutical companies do that is if they have promising results, let's say they have a trial where it looks like the drug really works in a certain subset of patients, generally they would give sort of a high level of that information to the FDA, and we would meet with the pharmaceutical company to talk about sort of the high level results and then advise them whether or not it was felt that those data were adequate to support approval of the drug. But it's really up to either the pharmaceutical company or if it was individual investigators or whoever sort of generated that data, they would be the ones who would submit that information to FDA and sort of make their case why they thought the data were adequate. And we would work with either the pharmaceutical company or the investigators to sort of give more specifics about what would be needed to actually support approval of the drug for ME/CFS. So I think that could really apply to any potential drug. I mean, FDA is very open to working with any either investigator or pharmaceutical company who is interested in seeking approval for ME/CFS. And really what we need is just for people or companies who are interested in that pathway to come to us, because I think we have the highest likelihood of success if we have sort of communication and dialogue with the different stakeholders to make sure we're all kind of on the same page, knowing what data are available so that we can work together. So I think that pathway could be, while it'd be different in each exact situation, it would really involve a dialogue working with pharmaceutical companies. And we're very open to working with whoever would be interested in pursuing a drug approval for ME/CFS.
So just to be clear, the maker of rituximab would approach the FDA once they had the information about the trial results, and that would just begin the process. For that particular drug being brand new for consideration, how long would that process take?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of your question.
How long would that process take?
To actually get, sort of meet with the FDA and have those discussions?
Yeah, to have the drug approved for use, you know, it wouldn't be off-label use. It would be for use for this disease in
this country. So the timelines really just depend on what needs to be done. So if clinical data are already available and it's felt that that data could be reviewed and potentially support approval, then the timeline would be more just how long it would take the pharmaceutical company to submit the information to FDA. And then depending on exactly what was submitted, it would have a different timeline of review, but it would just be review of that information. So I guess it's hard for me to give, like, an exact timeline because it would really depend on the situation and the type of information that was being submitted, because obviously if a drug company started a clinical trial today, it would take a long time to generate all the data to support the drug approval, but if the data are already available and we're just they're just submitting that data, it would be more of them getting the information to us and then us reviewing the information. But FDA does have sort of very clearly articulated times that it takes us to do different things, like in terms of how long it takes us to have a meeting with a pharmaceutical company or how long it takes us to review data that's submitted to support drug approval. So I think there would be a lot of transparency with the pharmaceutical company about how long things would be wouldn't necessarily take. And so it wouldn't necessarily be a very long timeline, just depending on the exact situation we're talking about.
So, Janet, do you mean like it would maybe be a year or maybe be 5 years? What do you mean by it? Not a long timeline?
Well, I guess I'm trying to say that the situation just depends, right?
Right. But what's closer? What is it closer to, a year or 5 years or 3 months? I mean, some kind of a range, I guess, I'd be looking for.
Right. So, I mean, it depends on what is submitted. If it was sort of a drug that's already approved and then they're submitting the information that's already gathered, let's just say that there's already information gathered, and that could be it could be submitted like tomorrow, then it could potentially be sort of less than a year. It just depends on, because the limiting factors aren't always necessarily FDA's review of the data. Frequently, pharmaceutical companies need to organize and get the data ready to submit to FDA, and depending on what they need to do, that can involve some time. So it's just, there's a lot of sort of variables that would make it impossible for me to say exactly how long it would take. Right, but clearly if you have existing data that could be easily submitted to FDA to review, then it's not nearly as long of a timeline. Does that make sense?
Okay. And then on the Ampligen thing, and I'm not up to date on Ampligen or where they are in any approvals or any trials, but am I clear in understanding that you're saying they could just resubmit the same information that they already presented the FDA with And now that you have, you would look at it again now knowing more about the disease?
No, I guess what I'm saying is that we are totally open to working with any sponsor, and that includes, you know, sponsors who have already performed trials and have data available. So I think it's totally reasonable for companies to talk to us about their specific situation.
Okay.
Janet,
this is Gary.
Go ahead.
This is Gary. Can I pop in for a sec?
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things I want to emphasize is that even with FDA approval of a drug, the insurance companies may still not cover it. We run into this all the time with increasing frequency. And so, yeah, there's a piece of it. Unquestionably, we want to get it through the FDA for approval if it's appropriate, but you're going to hit a big road blockade when you run into the insurance companies being willing to pay for it. And so financially, the drugs may still be unavailable.
And I had this is Faith Nick. I had a question also, Janet. Do advocacy groups petition the pharmaceutical companies to submit drugs to the FDA? I mean, do they go in that route to try to get drugs supported?
So this is Janet Maynard. I think there has been a variety of different situations from sort of patient advocacy groups working with pharmaceutical companies to help support drug approval. You know, I think probably there could be lots of different examples. And I do think, you know, has been mentioned, I think, a lot yesterday also was sort of the importance of stakeholder communications. So I agree that if the patient advocacy group would like to sort of work and support the pharmaceutical company to help them understand the significant unmet need of patients with ME/CFS, that to me seems reasonable.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from any of the other SIPSAC members? We're at about 1:35, and I believe Dr. Levine is also on now, the other co-chair.
Faith, we have to... What we have to do now, we have to have the operator contact or Mr. Miller, if you are on, press #0 so you can provide your public comment. Following Mr. Miller's comments, because we have more time for public comments, Sarita has put up on the webinar the questions that were drafted by the Medical Education Work Group for members of the public to address. And then, last but not least, if Charmaine and Mary Dimmock are listening, can you also press #0? They are members of the subcommittees, and they wanted to address any questions that the public might have. So let's start with Mr. Miller. You are on the line.
Gustavo, this is Ben. Did you mean to say *0? You said #0.
Oh, I'm sorry, *0.
Thanks, Ben.
So, operator, Charmaine,
yes.
Mr. Miller,
Charmaine's line is open.
This is Charmian Proskauer.
How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Charmian.
Is Robert Millen on the line? Can you press *0?
Charmian, do you have a question or comment?
I had a question. Are we still able to give questions on the previous updates?
Yes, you can go ahead, correct? Gustavo, she's fine.
Well, I'm letting Charmaine speak because she was a member of the work group, and Mary Dimmock asked that if she and Charmaine could be able
to... Okay.
It's Charmian, not Charmaine. Charmian.
Charmian, yeah. I'm sorry, English is not my first language. So, but if you have a question for any other presentations, go ahead.
That's okay? Okay, that would be great. Thank you. My question is for Drew Helmer. First of all, I'm delighted that the VA has an ex officio on this committee because I think there are tremendous opportunities to understand better the prevalence of ME/CFS in the veterans population. And I think the VA being a centrally managed organization, medical organization with outreach to a very large patient population and potentially comprehensive and organized medical education gives us tremendous opportunities in working with ME/CFS. So thank you for being here. I hope that you will become even more involved over time. I do have a concern, however, in what you said about ME/CFS currently being under the category of, I believe you called it chronic multisystem disease?
Chronic multisystem illness.
Illness, yes. Because CFS has particular characteristics, and many studies have shown that it is different from Gulf War illness, for example. And so I think we need to be very careful, particularly with diagnosis and also with treatment, to make sure that ME/CFS is separated out and treated appropriately. For example, graded exercise therapy, which is often recommended for chronic medically unexplained illnesses and so on, is not an appropriate treatment for ME/CFS and can actually harm patients. So I think there's good reason to take special care and make sure that the VA is applying appropriate diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS and that the treatment guidelines are unique and specific for ME/CFS and not general ones for chronic multisystem illness. I don't know that you meant that from what you said, but it sounded like that confusion could arise. The second part of my question is, you mentioned that there was some education already on chronic multisystem illness and that might be applied to ME/CFS. Is that something that those of us in the patient community could look at to see what the content of that medical education is and perhaps give you some feedback on whether we feel that it is appropriate or perhaps not for ME/CFS?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the comments. I think you're highlighting the reason that I kind of tipped my toes into the conversation today with a very brief overview, and I really appreciate the feedback. I agree that there is actually a lot of concern about, you know, how does this chronic multisymptom illness label fit with the distinct entities that are better defined, like ME/CFS, or even Gulf War illness, for that matter. So I think that's an area of active inquiry and continued understanding, search for understanding. With regard to the educational materials, they are publicly available. We have them on the RISC website, and maybe I could work with Gustavo to disseminate some of the links to the web-based versions of those. The e-learning modules I mentioned, which are being developed, are actually going to be publicly available through the TRAIN platform. The other webinars and some of the other educational materials we have are on a VA-only platform that's not generally accessible by the public. But I can certainly find some way to share those with you.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe now we're going to go to the public for questions answering the medical education work group that are posted right now.
So, operator, if you don't mind announcing to members of the public how to speak to the
Thank
rest
you.
Of the committee.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. And we have a question from Roberta Davis. Your line is open.
Thank you. Go ahead, Roberta.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for the presentations this morning. A technical question I would have is, for our next meeting, will you have the slides available for those of us who are the patients, like we've had in earlier meetings? I love looking at Gustafa and Sarita, but I would also appreciate seeing the slides that the presenters are showing everyone else, and visually it would help me with my concentration and focus.
You haven't been able to see any of the slides this afternoon?
No, and yesterday either. All I'm seeing is the room where they're sitting.
Gustavo, can you give her a little direction on that?
Do you click on the webinar link using Google Chrome, which was sent via the listserv? I'm not sure if you are on the listserv.
Oh, maybe I wasn't using the right. Oh, I didn't use Google Chrome probably. All right, so that was probably a mistake on my part. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here's my question, and it's probably for NIH. Realistically, as a patient, I understand that you need this critical mass of researchers who are going to submit applications. How do we help connect our practitioners or entice our practitioners to want to connect with the academics and get into this translational process and apply for these grants? How realistically do we do that? And to which of our specialists do we direct our attention? I mean, should it be our primary? Should it be the neurologist? Should it be the gastroenterologist? I mean, which of our doctors should we try to entice into this circle? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, this is Vicki Whittemore. Thank you for that question. It's a very good question. So, the way I would answer that right now, this may change after we fund the centers, but I'm hoping that this is what will happen. It's likely that once the centers are up and running, they will begin recruiting participants for various studies within the centers. And it will be really helpful for all of you to be able to get the word out to other individuals with ME/CFS and to clinicians to help to refer individuals into those studies. So I think that is a way that a clinician who sees individuals with ME/CFS, regardless of what specialty is,
okay,
if they know of someone that could participate and may really benefit from being part of, they always tell us you don't benefit from a clinical trial, right, or a clinical study. If they could qualify, that's the word I'm looking for, qualify to participate in a clinical study, that would be a really superb use of clinicians across the country. So
okay,
I think we'll work with probably through CIFSAC as well as through other federal agencies as well as the advocacy groups to begin to get the word out as soon as we're at that point. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, that makes very good sense. Yes. And the centers, where are they located again?
We don't know that yet. So
the
applications will be reviewed, and we'll be able to announce that after they're approved in council.
Okay.
In September.
Okay. All right. Would you be able to speak more about the subset of patients that are beginning to be recognized? Would anybody be able to speak more about that?
I can, but I think not to tie up time. One of the things that I might suggest, if this is okay, Faith, would be that we could have that be a presentation at the next CIFSAC meeting.
That sounds like a good idea, actually. A very good idea.
Okay.
So we will, let me just write that down quickly. And Vicki, I'll send you a follow-up email to make sure I've got it right.
Sure.
Thanks.
And I likely would ask my colleagues who are, especially the immunology folks, I'm a neuroscientist, and to participate so that they can be more knowledgeable and answer questions better than I could about that. So.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you so much. I won't take up any more time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Sue Ellen. Your line is open.
I'm sorry, I don't want to take time, but it's administrative. I cannot, as I did yesterday, click on the link for the webinar, nor see even get to your site, nor see the slides. Could someone just email me the information or tell me how I could overcome that? I was fine yesterday. Sorry.
Just give us your email, please.
That's MRST, like Mrs. T, like Tom, 2222@gmail.com. Mrs. T, 4 2s@gmail.com. Sorry, but
I'll see if I can do that for you.
I have to see it visually, too. And having the slides ahead of time also, I echo that, will help us cognitively impaired folks greatly. Thanks for that question, Roberta.
And our next speaker, please, operator. Thank you.
Samantha, your line is open.
Hello. Can I be heard?
Yes, go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you very much. My name is Samantha Lyons. I'm currently 24 out of Ohio. I had three short questions, or really points to consider. The first is I've actually been suffering gradually worse since I was around 16 years old or went into puberty, but it wasn't until about 2 or 3 years ago that I finally got diagnosed after a lot of testing, and only because I had a very experienced nurse practitioner. But even until now, I'm still constantly learning things. So the idea is kind of if there could be like a beginner's manual or information, some sort of like online booklet or something for people who have been diagnosed to figure out, you know, what is parts of this disease, what are common ailments, that would be pretty awesome, because I'm pretty sure many of the people listening know information's pretty spread out and it's hard to get a clear idea of what could be part of this and what could be random. The second one was, this was kind of asked a couple minutes ago, but the study volunteers, like I'd personally be interested, but I've heard there's studies that will be looking into like treatments with CRISPR and such, since it's mitochondrial. And do any of you guys know anywhere where like they're posting looking for volunteers for these studies or anything?
I don't know.
Vicki, and I'm not aware of those studies, but I can investigate that for you.
Thank you. All right. And just the last point was something I have seen again and again is many organizations are looking for a different name for the disorder because of the stigma of people brushing off like chronic fatigue syndrome, thinking it's the symptom, et cetera. And I don't know if this is the right venue for it, but I just had the thought of one thing you could be renamed to would be Aya syndrome after the character Aya, who's the main character from Parasite Eve, which the short story of it is it has a lot to do with mitochondria, and since they're saying this is a mitochondrial disease, it seemed rather fitting. So that was all, and thank you guys very much for your time.
Sue Ellen, thank you. If you want to email me, we can help you set up, get you some information out about the disease and link you up with some of the advocates.
My email is F as in Faith Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, at desu.edu, and it should be posted somewhere. So again, desu.edu, or Gustavo will have it. You can just email the SIPSAC, and we will see what we can do to help you out. Thank you for your comments and your suggestions.
And this is Beth Unger. Could I just mention something?
Yeah, go ahead, Beth.
The ACFS ME primer is available for download on their website. And the pediatric primer, even though it's the caller wasn't a pediatric patient, has also very good information, and that has just been published. And that's a good area.
You know what? You would think I would have thought of that. Thank you, Beth, very much. Yeah, we can send you a link to the pediatric primer. You can just look it up. Even though you are 24, a lot of it is applicable. And the adult primer also is applicable. Again,
and where could I find those?
Say that one more time.
Sorry, where could I find those, or what was that email again?
The email is fnewton, N-E-W-T-O-N, at desu.edu. Or you can just look up Frontiers in Pediatrics, and the primer, this pediatric primer should bring it up.
Thank you very much. You all have a wonderful day.
You too, and thank you very much for calling in. Do we have any other speakers on the line?
This is Charmian. My husband, Alan Gerwitt, has a question.
Go ahead, Alan.
Okay. In listening to telecast or autocast, it seems to me that what has not happened yet is that the federal government and its various health agencies have not declared simply and clearly that ME is a biological illness. You imply that by all the good work that I hear you're doing, but it hasn't declared definitively that this is an organic illness. We here in Massachusetts have a terrible time finding physicians who are knowledgeable and placing patients with them. And it's because of the false information that was spread by British psychiatrists about the psychological nature of ME. It is not psychological. It is an organic illness. And unless the federal health agencies so declare, we are facing a very powerful uphill battle.
Do any of the ex officios want to comment, Dr. Whittemore or Dr. Unger, or am I?
I mean, it's a very good point. I think the IOM was very clear on saying that, and I think that the materials coming out should be help clarify this. And definitely we'll keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gerwitt, for your comments. Do we have any other speakers on the line? Do we want to move on to Gustavo? Do we want to move on to-
This is Ben Seaborger. If I could ask one follow-up question Vicky.
Ben.
Thanks. So, Vicky, you talked in your presentation about increasing collaborative efforts with other organizations, private organizations that would fund research. And I wondered if you could clarify, are there any efforts underway for the NIH to also increase collaboration with organizations that don't do funding? Or are you only looking at collaboration in terms of organizations that will fund research?
So, very good question. No, we are open to working with and partnering with all groups. And so, typically, if we set up a group, it has a focus. So, for example, the example I've used before that we are thinking of modeling an ME-CFS group after is ICARE. It's a group that comes together
to talk specifically about funding for epilepsy research, but, you know, that also can entail discussions about training new investigators, training, you know, the upcoming clinician scientists, can really involve other discussions. So that's a long way of saying we are not just interested in partnering with those who fund research, but with partnering with all advocacy groups. So I'm sorry if I implied that.
No, thank you. That's very helpful. And sorry, if I can just ask one more question. This is actually to Dr. Unger. Some of the patients in our network brought up to me a question that they have been trying to ascertain through Freedom of Information requests, what's the amount of money that the CDC spent on the previous IOM report. And to my knowledge so far, it's been years and they still haven't received any answer about this. Is that a piece of information you could provide us with that now that this report has already been finished several years ago, can we have that public information on how much the CDC spent on the IOM report contract?
sorry, this is Beth Unger, and CDC was not the sole funder of this report. It was CDC did make a contribution, and how to disclose that information I think is a little beyond where I'm at, but we did provide the information to Gustavo, and I assume there's going to be an HHS response, but it definitely was not solely funded by CDC.
Sure, but so you provided the information to Gustavo on what CDC's contribution was?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a contribution between my understanding. This also predates me, and it goes back to Nancy Lee, who was the DFO. But it was funded by this office, by OASH, with contribution from NIH and CDC.
And are you sure none of the other ex officios contributed? That there might have been somebody else in there. I don't know.
So, Gustavo, in the interest of time, could I follow up with you later to get some of that information on what the contribution was to that report?
Yeah, send me an email. We can talk on the phone.
This is Donna. I'll just add, although the figures are not disclosed, the IOM report actually lists all the agencies that contributed to funding it. It was definitely, maybe four or five, six or seven, I don't remember how many, but there was a number of them.
Thank you, Donna. Great. I thought that's what it was.
Gustavo?
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Gary Kaplan. Gustavo, can I address some of the questions here that were on the medical education work group? Because we had a number of respondents prior to the conference and wanted to just give a brief summary of the data that we got back.
Sure.
So with regards, I'm sorry?
You want us to put up your presentation?
No, stay right here first, because what I'm going to do is just a brief summary of the respondents to these questions that were put out.
Okay.
And then we'll move on to the presentation.
Thank you. This is Donna.
Yes.
Did you get my document?
I did not.
Oh, I wrote up a document for you. Nora was supposed to send it to you. Okay.
Okay. I was in transit most of today, so I apologize for not getting that. But what let me summarize what I've got, and then Donna, you can add to that.
Okay.
And then we'll go on from there.
All right.
So, you know, we had about 17 people respond, and I want to thank everybody who did so. You know, listening to these stories and reading through this stuff is truly heartbreaking, and I'm profoundly embarrassed for my profession. The way people who have this disease is treated is shameful, and is just gut-wrenching. And I'm so sorry that you've had to endure this, and we will hopefully make this better as we move into the future. The first question was with regards to what are the three most important things you want your physician and other healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, registered nurses to know about your disease? And overwhelmingly, the answer came back that the disease is real. It's not caused by a lack of motivation or psychological factors. They want people to understand, the physicians, the caretakers, to understand that this is a systemic disease, that it's not just, you know, fatigue, but rather it involves issues of brain fog and POTS and gut disorders. And so it's a very complex problem that is multisystemic. They talk about wanting to have access to telemedicine. Thus, you know, one woman had said that I was forced past my energy envelope and had a nasty flare-up for a month. Just going to a doctor shouldn't have to make us sick. The doctor doesn't see what's going on when we leave the office. I mean, these were not unusual comments. And then the other thing, their comments were the necessity of getting out good therapy data, because the graded exercise therapy, the PACE trials, have proven harmful, and we really need to get the message across to physicians of first do no harm, and certainly following these recommendations are doing harm. The other problem, of course, that people always run into is that the doctor should not rely on the patient's appearance to judge the illness severity, because the illness fluctuates. So that was just another quote from one of the other commenters. Question two, since P2P and IOM reports, have you found the access to clinical care easier, harder, or about the same? Unfortunately, pretty much across the board, the answer was not easier. The same, no difference. We're not seeing in the field, at least from this limited survey, the impact of P2P and IOM in clinical care. And one patient wrote back and said, you know, doctors tend to make me feel unwelcome when they learn my diagnosis. This is just a disgrace. Question three was, do you believe that the physicians you're seeing are interested in learning about ME/CSF? Now, this question was inspired actually by a comment we had on the phone in one of the subcommittee meetings, and Ted particularly brought this comment up, question up. He says, you know, what we can do all this stuff, but if we don't have a willing audience, who are we talking to? And so I decided to pose this question to the community and say, okay, what are you finding? And the answer was, no, I don't believe my physician's interested in learning about this stuff. There's too much deep-rooted prejudice against the illness. This is another barrier we're going to have to figure out how to overcome in terms of providing education. We need people who want the education. And then, do you believe this attitude has changed much since P2P and IOM? Unfortunately, the answer for the most part was not at all. There was one particularly interesting comment that said, only in researchers and journalists. So we seem to have made a dent potentially in getting the researchers on board wanting to be interested in this illness and journalists, but we're not, again, getting to the clinicians the way we need to. Number five is, do you believe that social workers, psychologists, and or psychiatrists are interested in learning about ME/CSF? If yes, what specifically would they be interested in learning about? Some felt that this was a little bit too much for care providers. They'd like to see where they can help, but they felt, quote, it was a step too far for other healthcare providers, even though they must learn about the disease. One particularly poignant comment of Kate Brown that caught my eye was, I would like to not be the expert in the room when I'm a care provider. So we've got a lot of work to do. While I think P2P and IOM are extremely important and groundbreaking in terms of moving this disease forward and more to the forefront, we have a long way to go in order to be able to get care to people. Tommy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I kind of crossed off the things that you mentioned, and I'll just I'll point out a couple other things. And this is worth stressing, because pretty much everybody said this, they want providers to know with absolute certainty that this is a biologically based disease and that it causes multisystemic dysfunction, it's high on the morbidity index, and it results in a greatly diminished quality of life. And they really want educational materials to actively repudiate the psychosocial narrative and make it abundantly clear that the disease is not MUPS and it's not a diagnosis of exclusion. The other thing that was high on the list was for doctors to understand that PEM is very real, and that a patient's definition of overexertion is not that of a normal person, and also that physicians should respect the patient's knowledge of their own energy limits. And you did talk about this, Gary, where, I mean, I know this happens all the time. People go to the doctor and they crash. And then the third most frequently mentioned thing is doctors need to know that it's not just about fatigue. It needs to be clear that it's it doesn't revolve around fatigue, but rather around limited energy creation or energy reserves, and that it also has unusual sensitivity to stressors of all kinds, and they typically destroy the patient's life due to the limitations it imposes. And one person suggested that the metabolomics research should be shared in medical education materials. And then I just don't want to leave out the neurocognitive dysfunction. Not as many people listed that, but at least three or four people did say that providers need to understand that. A couple other comments about that, rapid diagnosis, early intervention, and ongoing support is the best care. And proper diagnosis is extremely valuable, whether or not treatment exists. And one person said, I'm not even looking for them to cure me. I just need their help to live a life of any quality. I think that's pretty important for doctors to know. On the one of the, I got a little bit more detailed, and that's, do you believe the physicians you're seeing are interested in learning about the disease? Most people, as you said, Gary, feel that they don't. But I had one person who wrote a really good comment, and that was, one has to make them be interested. I think it was Margaret who did this, and she lists things that would help, and I know the committee has seen that. But I tend to agree. You need to make them interested in getting the right information out there, letting them know it's their responsibility to treat, rejecting the false narratives of the disease, giving them some idea of how they can help patients. And that's it. Okay?
We have a lot of work to do. Donna, thank you. We clearly have a lot of work to do. Gustavo, can we move on to the presentation?
Yes, Arita is going to bring it up. We'll move the slides for you, Gary.
Okay, you'll move them forward?
Yes.
Please. Okay, so if we can. So if we move on. Okay, so this is the group of people who are participating in this committee. It truly takes a village, and I want to really acknowledge the fact that everybody on this list has contributed in significant ways, and everybody's working very hard. This is an interim report. We are going to ask for specific approval for movements or recommendations from the advisory committee. At this point, we will have that ready at the next meeting. But we have, you know, as you go through this, you'll see there's a lot of issues that we have to address and still need to address as we go through this. So just want to make sure I acknowledge and thank everybody on this committee, because everybody has been participating. Next slide, please. So the committee's original charge was to formulate a series of recommendations to the secretary on how to improve education for healthcare providers in ME/CFS. We took that, and if you'll go to the next slide, and we kind of broke that down into three sub-questions, clearly overlapping, but allowing us to come at it from a couple of different directions so we could begin to understand not only the potential avenues for providing education, but more importantly, the barriers that we're facing. So we had one group of people doing provide progressive ME/CFS education to healthcare providers. Another was looking at disseminated clinical practice guidelines, best practices. And the third was identify potential mechanisms to expand the base of providers capable to able to diagnose and care for persons with ME/CFS. Next slide, please. Next slide. Great. So with regard to that first point, provide progressive ME/CFS education to healthcare providers, particularly Terry Weidler and Mary Dimock worked very hard on this particular area. And looking at provide a wide array of progressive ME/CFS education, training, resources, and tools to healthcare providers. And we've expanded clearly, not just to physicians, but also into naturopaths and physician assistants, nurse practitioners, RN, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists. Basically, we're trying to get the whole array of people who potentially come in contact, especially on a first-line basis, with people struggling with this disease. And the other was continuing education options to incentivize participation in specialist support for healthcare providers inexperienced in the field. So this starts to address this business of, okay, how do we make our audience interested in what we're talking about? Certainly provision of CME is one thing, continuing medical education credits, that always seems to attract physicians. But we need to figure out how do we get people wanting to have this information. Next slide, please. So potential solutions, and I want to say that Terry in particular has a great deal of experience with this in New York, using the model with AIDS. And so we talked about toll-free ME-CFS line to connect healthcare providers to highly knowledgeable specialists regarding the disease, training and conferences on ME-CFS and related topics, ME-CFS Project ECHO. So Project ECHO is Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes. This was pioneered at the University of New Mexico, specifically looking for trying to disseminate information for the treatment of hepatitis and taking that model and potentially utilizing it for people struggling with ME-CFS. And what this does is it connects an expert in the field with people out in the community, physicians out in the community, mostly through telemedicine conferences, and gives them ongoing guidance and support in terms of treating patients out in the field. Looking at ME-CFS intensive mini residencies, practicing medical providers, so that's bringing people in for a week, 2 weeks, to be able to learn from an expert how to treat these conditions. We have a similar model to this in Lyme disease, where iLabs has set up 1 to 2 week intensives with experts in the field of Lyme. The point is that we have models we can follow and develop from it. Technical assistance and clinical tools, always empowering our providers so that they actually feel like they can accomplish something, and guidance on websites. So these are potential solutions to beginning to address the dissemination of information. Next slide, please. Next slide. So in terms of disseminating clinical practice guidelines and best practices, Charmaine, Elizabeth, and Robin were spearheading this effort and produced a huge amount of information which we're going to need to consolidate, but which gives us a really wonderful basis for getting information out and understanding within the government structure how we can disseminate this information. So the first thing was what existing mechanisms are available to disseminate clinical guidance, best practices for care of people with ME-CFS, what educational content or resources are available, and again, perhaps most importantly here, as we'll get to this toward the end, is what are the gaps. Next slide, please. So compiling a database, an idea grid, which it's actually at the beginnings of, and it's a big grid, and it's extremely useful, of disseminating options, tools for prioritizing and identifying gaps. So evaluate audience, geographic scope, program type, cost, funding plan, who is responsible, obstacles to success, difficulty conducting, impact assessment plan. So this is a full service thing in terms of it, in a sense, interactive, that you're identifying who your audience is, but you're also getting some feedback from the audience in terms of understanding what their needs are. And this also talks about who's going to be doing what and what their responsibilities are. And that's extremely important, because if we just come up with ideas and we don't have mechanisms for true implementation, then nothing happens. Critical need for approved content for dissemination. This is the biggest bugaboo, and we'll come back and talk about this in a minute. But criteria for content. Evidence-based, clearly whenever possible. If not, then based on expert advice gathered and evaluated systematically. Treatment needs to be included in content. Message should be consistent across federal agencies, certainly a problem we've encountered, and must be tailored to the audience. So again, who are we addressing? Are we addressing physicians? Are we addressing nurse practitioners? Or are we addressing the public? So the information needs to be at the appropriate level for the appropriate audience. Next, please. identify potential mechanisms to expand the base of providers able to diagnose and care for persons with ME/CFS. Ted and Mary did a great deal of work on this, identifying barriers to access to clinical care along with potential solutions, and expand the base of providers able to diagnose and care for patients with ME/CFS. Next slide, please. The barriers, and these are the things that we really need to focus on, I think, in our upcoming meetings and how we're going to fix this. Anticipated loss of disease expertise and lack of providers. One of the things that's happening, unfortunately, is we've not seen lots of new young physicians moving into this area, but rather we have a lot of physicians who have been treating these conditions for many years. They're starting to age out, and we're at really serious risk of losing an incredible wealth of data from these experts and need their clinical in terms of guiding treatment as we move forward. So we need to figure out some way to capture that data. The Institute of Medicine, the P2P, reports gave validity to the disease and guidance to diagnosis, but it provided no treatment recommendations. This, again, speaks to the first problem as well. Without treatment recommendations, we have a massive problem because we don't know what to tell people what to do. And there's nothing more disempowering to physicians than saying, congratulations, you have, and I remember this from training, I walked into a patient's room. We had just diagnosed him with Jankovic-Creutzfeldt, which is a degenerative neurologic condition, and congratulations, we know what you have. You'll not have any memory of this conversation, and there's nothing we can do for you. That does not encourage physicians to want to go treat these things, and so we really have to put some tools in their hands so that they can feel empowered, so they feel good about being able to effectively interact with patients who are struggling with this disease and provide appropriate guidance and treatment. Negative attitudes, stigma, disbelief, and misconceptions, a huge problem within the field that needs to be addressed. ME/CFS is endorsed by the community, but incompletely accepted by major medical groups and large medical societies. So what we're going to have to do here is we're going to have to figure out a way is first, what's the message? What is it we want to tell them? Okay, we've got good guidance from IOM and P2P in terms of diagnosis of the disease, but then what? How do we treat it? And we have to get that information into the medical community, and that can be done predominantly through lectures at major society-endorsed conferences and also in major society-endorsed publications. But again, we need to know what that message is. We're going to have to figure out how to do that. Limiting medical practice, medical office practices, and financial challenges. With, you know, everybody's squeezed at this point, these 5-10-minute visits, which are dictated by insurance limitations, are not acceptable for truly being able to stand, understand and treat diseases as complex as ME/CFS. And then, of course, we're always struggling with the lack of research data. But that's going to change, and we've now got NIH ready to fund these centers, and we've got real money starting to move into the system to make that, so there's much reason for optimism. It's not moving anywhere near as fast as we want it to and needs to, but nevertheless, this is a major sea change from where we were just 2 years ago. Next slide, please. So potential solutions, defining criteria for identifying acceptable sources of content for clinical guidelines. Certainly we have the IACFS ME primer. That's a few years dated at this point in time. It needs some sprucing up. And the new pediatric primer. It's a place to start, and maybe that we can come to an agreement, but somewhere along the line, we have to come to an agreement about what it is we're going to be putting out in terms of not just diagnosis, but treatment recommendations. The provision of telemedicine for underserved, unserved areas, and I do want to emphasize the unserved, not underserved. One of the women who responded to the questionnaire said that she had moved to New Mexico and found that there was no provider available to her in the entire state who could address her condition, and she literally had to move out of the state in order to get care. This is an unbelievable severe problem. Proactive knowledge retention programs, this is going back to picking up the skills and wisdom of the clinicians who have been treating these conditions for years so that we don't lose that data. Provide remote support for medical providers by disease experts. Again, we're going to have to figure out where we're getting those experts from and agree upon what the appropriate data is. you know, you start getting somebody who decides they're an expert and saying PACE is the way to go and GET is the way to go, we have a problem. So that we've got to get on the same page. We have to try to understand how we can make appropriate recommendations to the secretary to be able to accomplish this. Experts presenting at key conferences to influence providers, again, that's something else that we want to be seeing. But I think the very first thing, if you go to the next slide, I think that's it. The real challenge here is trying to understand what the message is. And that's what we're going to be addressing over the next couple of months, to understand how to get, all right, we've got treatment guidelines, we've got diagnostic guidelines at least. Now we need officially sanctioned treatment guidelines, and it's going to have to draw both on research, which unfortunately is fairly scant, but a lot on expert opinion. And we have to figure out what the mechanism of that is going to be within the government in order to be able to get on the same page and then be able to disseminate this information. I'm open to any questions. Next slide. I think we're done. Yep.
Gary, this is Mary. Can I add on to what you just
said? Absolutely.
I want to speak to the clinical guidelines. One of the challenges that we face, and I don't quite know what the solution is to this yet, but our clinical guidelines across the board, and I'm not talking CDC specifically, I'm talking about across the board different guidelines and guidance, still include CBT and GET, still include the biopsychosocial theories. And the problem we have is that those studies continue to be pumped out, and they have like a virtual pipeline right into clinical education. And so we need to find a way to it's going to take a lot of leadership from HHS and the medical societies to proactively break that link, because until we do, it's going to be very difficult to address the stigma and to address the mistreatment of patients. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges we face. And it actually, to go back to the case definition discussion we had earlier, it links back to that, because we still have case definitions that are overly broad that are producing these guidelines and ending up in medical education. Thank you.
Completely agree. Any other members of the working group want to comment and add on? Because you guys have been doing a lot of work. A deafening silence. Beth, I'm going to put you on the spot, because you guys put together a huge flow sheet in terms of how we can disseminate this information. But I'm trying to get some understanding about what government mechanism. Once upon a time, we had consensus conferences at NIH, but what mechanisms that we could potentially work within the government in order to get consensus on treatments by utilizing expert opinion?
This is Beth, and I would say that there's not a formal process, or not one only process, and this is something that we are discussing. So we don't have an answer yet. We just recognize the need. And it's particularly challenging because the traditional methods for consensus rely on published literature, and we have to find a way around that, because in this particular case, the literature is only part of the picture, and a minor part of the picture.
Anyone else want to add on? Terry? Ted?
This is Mary. I had another follow-up question. Is there one of the key issues we face is the magnitude of the stigma that's holding everything back? The IOM recently produced a report that was reported on in the educational initiative that CDC ran about what it takes to overcome that stigma. Is there any program anywhere within HHS that could be leveraged that's been used to address that magnitude of stigma in the past that we could use as a model?
So you're hearing the challenge. We are struggling to find a mechanism. Somebody you want to help out?
This is Vicki. Can I comment?
Absolutely.
So we looked at this issue of stigma around epilepsy after the Epilepsy ILM report, well, during and after the report was released on epilepsy. And, you know, so there were a couple of things that happened. I think within that Epilepsy ILM report, it was recognized that it really falls to the advocacy groups in large part working together with professionals to try to dispel the stigma of the disease. That's not to say that HHS doesn't have a role, and so please don't think that that's what I'm saying. NIH had a grant mechanism specifically to address stigma in specific disease entities that was on the streets for many years and attracted very few applications across any disease entity. So I think that there are ways to address it, but it really, I think, takes a concerted thought process as to how to address it from multiple angles, not, you know, public awareness, physician awareness, potential research efforts. I think it really takes a thinking through many different approaches to addressing stigma.
And Vicki, is there any mechanism within NIH at this point that's similar to what we used to do with the consensus conferences?
Unfortunately, no. They did away with support for consensus conferences and, again, sort of pushed it off to the relevant, whatever disease-relevant advocacy group is, to organize those. I think they're sometimes organized within research conferences such that then the research conference can get support through an R13 conference grant, but it technically can't be called a consensus conference.
And I'm sorry, what's the number for that grant?
R13.
Oh, okay. Yes.
This is Donna. I'm wondering if our HRSA member talked about grants, and I'm wondering if the challenge of the stigma might specifically be something that would be appropriate for a grant through HRSA.
Donna, I was wondering if Joel was presenting on a number of facets that might provide some opportunity from HRSA. So that's another one. And I was going to follow up with him after this meeting. But that's a great idea to see what's possible there. And Joel, if you're still on the line, yeah.
This is Faith. That's an excellent question, Donna and Mary.
Hey, Joel, are you on the line? We lost him. Okay. Can we decide that and reflect in the minutes that we feel that this is something we should follow up with him about? Is this not what IPSEC would do? Probably not, actually, now that I think about it.
It is absolutely. We on the subcommittee will go.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
Okay, so Gary, you'll handle it as a subcommittee?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else?
This is Ben Suborder.
That was an excellent presentation.
Sorry, excuse me. This is Ben Suborder with ME Action. I just want to say, Dr. Kaplan, echo again, that was a very impressive presentation we received. And is that presentation available to send to the members of SIFAC? I didn't see it when it was the other presentations were circulated, so I was wondering if you could provide that to the other members.
Anybody's welcome. Gustavo, can you send that out?
Ben, the presentation will be on the SIFSAC website in probably about 3 weeks because they have to go through clearance by the department, what we call 508 compliance, to make sure that deaf and hard of hearing people can see it. But if you need it right away, I can send it to you. But if you're asking if it's going to be available to the public, it will be in 3 weeks on the website.
Gustavo,
yeah, no, I was asking if it could be circulated to the CIFAC members.
Yeah, but my understanding was that all of the non-voting liaisons are supposed to get every single thing that the voting people get.
I know, Donna, but Dr. Kaplan sent it to me a day before.
Oh, so you didn't, I saw it from him directly? All right.
My bad. We were editing this thing and going back and forth on it until two.
Not everybody meets the deadline because I tell them, you know, I need it by a certain time. So I send you what I get by the deadline that I set.
Hey, my apologies.
Okay. So do you guys want me to send it to all of you now?
Yes. This is Faith. Yes, could you please send that out to all of us?
Okay.
Thank you, Gustavo.
You're welcome. And sorry, just one other question. Was the epilepsy report that was being referred to, is that the 2012 Epilepsy Across the Spectrum Promoting Health and Understanding? I'm just wanting to clarify if that was what was being referred to.
Yes, that's what I was referring to. This is Vicki.
Thank you.
Do any of the other ex officios or CIFSAC members have any comments or questions for Gary and his group?
Or recommendations in terms of future direction? The HRSA thing is obviously one excellent and one we have to follow up with. But any ideas you have in terms of where else we should be looking?
Well, so again, this is Donna. I just want to remind everyone that at the meeting in January, we were attempting to submit a recommendation about asking HHS to identify funding from a combination of agencies so that we could incorporate the new evidence to refine the diagnosis and then also to incorporate evaluation as well. In other words, to hire, for example, an IOM-type committee to do this work. Dr. Kaplan said the strongest argument for reconvening a meeting is that a public health emergency exists. And I remember Dr. Montano said that there was a great body of knowledge within a small group of clinicians who really know the disease from dealing with directly. And it would be a huge step forward if we could combine an updated diagnosis with some type of clinical management. So the way we ended up leaving that was we did not submit a recommendation. Instead, Beth and Gustavo had agreed that they would work with the ex officios on how to implement what we wanted to do and see if there was any way to fund that. So that is something that we need to be thinking about because that's kind of part of this whole discussion about how are we going to come up with medical education and treatment guidelines.
This is Mary. I just want to add on to that. We really have a need for urgent action here because a number of our clinicians are reaching, not all of them, so let me be clear, but a number of our clinicians are reaching retirement age or are leaving their practices. And so we need to capture the knowledge of it's in their heads before that happens.
We might be held up because I know that Dr. Colin Sharp said that they were going to mention it with the new permanent ASH in the HHS.
Yeah, and the issue is don't have an ASH.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And the secretary is probably so busy doing other things that it's not even on there. I mean, we can't even get our members approved here, new members.
Exactly.
So I understand the issue. But I'm hoping that somehow we can work through the channels with maybe through the ex officios just to see if there's any money available to pull together like was done before. That's it.
Anybody else have any other comments? Gustavo, do we want to open it up to the public?
Yeah, we have 20 minutes before our break at 3 o'clock.
Right.
And actually, Faith, also, from 3:15 to 4 o'clock, we have discussion of the recommendation for the Medical Educational Work Group, but Dr. Kaplan do not have any. So we really, the only thing we have left to do from the agenda besides opening the lines to the public is to discuss the SOP.
So do you want to take that break and just move everything forward, or how do you want to do this?
Whichever way the committee wants to.
What is the best,
What's the pleasure of the rest of the committee?
This is Gary. I'm on a really tight schedule. If we want, could move forward and just finish up if you need me for a quorum. Otherwise, I'm going to have to sign off by the 6 o'clock.
I am fine with that. Donna, are you okay with that?
So we're just, yeah, we're going to hear from the public is what you're saying right now?
Hear from the public, the break, and just go right to SOP?
Yeah. Let's finish up what Gary needs to be involved with.
Right, I would agree.
So, Michelle? Catherine, I'm sorry. Can you instruct the public how to dial into the queue?
Certainly. Once again, if you would like to ask your question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name. Your name is required to announce your question. One moment for the next question. Once again, if you do have a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. We do have a question coming from Charlotte Flint. Your line is open.
Yes, can you hear me? This is Janet Flint.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, my first name is Janet. My last name is Flint, F-L-Y-N-T. I first wanted to just take a quick moment, and you know, I hear a lot of pain and criticism sometimes from patients as I listen to things, so I wanted just to express personally my heartfelt gratitude for what's being discussed, and I can see the momentum forward. I know it's difficult, and you're managing multiple things, and so I really appreciate it. Especially since I know energy is precious. As I look and watch the news, I am a Trump fan, so I'll get that out of the way right away. The current administration is emphasizing innovation to patient-centered care and public-private partnerships. And what I've heard from, I think it's Dr. Kaplan and others, that, you know, your funding is very, very tight. And also the attention of the DHHS secretary is spent or directed elsewhere. So coming from high-tech industry, having worked in both the public and private sector, and I just wonder if a clouds-down approach to getting, you know, a big boost in funding can occur, or coming both from the public government, you know, addressing Congress, and then also from the private sector, a lot of high-tech billionaires are talking about, you know, dedicating, and non-high-tech, dedicating their money to help, you know, even things in other countries. And so this is an issue, perhaps an emergency issue for public health in our country. And I know that's an emphasis of our the new administration, whether you agree with it or not. And so I just wondered, has anyone done like an elevator pitch for and a roadmap for Secretary Price that he could give to Congress that would, you know, give him the presentation that he needs, you know, to get attention to this? I don't know how this area works. As I said, my government, it was more high-tech. I worked in defense, NASA, and some medical devices and other things related to embedded electronics that control machines in the safety arena. So I'm totally out of my element here. So I just, you know, don't mean any disrespect, but I just think more needs to be done to kickstart this initiative and add to the momentum that y'all are working so very hard on, and I appreciate very much. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. I'll try to answer your question about bringing this issue to the attention of the Secretary Price. This would not, I mean, the recommendations put forward by this committee are sent by the Secretary through our boss, the Assistant Secretary for Health. It would not be something that directly would come from from the staff within HHS directly to the secretary, it would have to come through the committee. So it's a large bureaucracy, and unfortunately, things from your perspective as the public, it might look easier, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. But like I said, the recommendations do go to the secretary, made by this committee.
Okay, so, and I appreciate what you're saying. I guess I'm trying to think out of the box and what as a patient I could do to, and maybe it's through some of the societies, you know, that are in place, to complement what you're doing and get attention. I also don't hear, you know, I hear a lot of stuff about clinical trials, and again, I come from the high-tech background. I understand, you know, some of the statistical data analysis since I was involved some early in my career, but it seems to me like capturing the aging physician's knowledge, you know, there's IBM Watson out there, there may be some other tools, you know, the high-tech industry with the social media, you know, where is that in the solution space? Now, where you know, are there other things that could be brought to bear here? Can you give me an elevator pitch that one might make to, you know, some venture funding outside just the drug community? Because in my view, it's really the patient. I gave up thinking about doctors as, you know, gods because they're not. And I just, as a patient, would like to help other patients, self-help, learning how to advocate, but I don't have the energy to produce these documents, and so I would look to the government maybe to partner with, you know, whomever. I can't manage government projects anymore. So that, I guess that's my point. I'll leave it there. You can tell I'm tired and I'm getting a little bit emotional, and I do appreciate all your efforts, and I understand the government bureaucracy and getting funding very well.
Janet, this is Faith Newton, co-chair of CISAC. We have just added in the last 2 years advocacy groups, and some of those advocacy groups are doing a lot of, they're doing their work through the internet and through social media. I am sure that they would be more than willing to reach out to you to get your support and help. You put your name out there, and maybe somebody will give you a contact. If not, you can always contact me. I can pass your name along that way to see what we can do to give you some support.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Faith, for that. I do want to mention that I am started to link with the Solve ME-CFS initiative, and I've committed to doing a letter to our Senator Burr here in North Carolina. But I think I'll connect with some of the others, and I do appreciate that comment and your energies. Thank you.
Thanks. And this is Ben Duborger with ME Action. I just want to say, Janet, thanks for your comments. If you want to have some discussions about maybe non-traditional ways we can think outside the box and get some elevator pitches to some influential people, you can contact us at info@meaction.net, info@meaction.net, and I'd be happy to talk further with you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Janet. Are there any other speakers on the line willing that have comments?
We have no further questions in queue at this time.
Gustavo, so Gary, do we need to do anything else to move forward with you?
Yeah, hi. No, I think I've got from here, and then we just got to get the committee back together. I think Nora's, my research assistant, is in the process of setting up the next meeting. The idea of crowdfunding and this outside the box stuff, what we need to do is, you know, how do we get recommendations from the secretary? But the idea of doing crowdfunding, I don't know, getting a white paper conference together, maybe going through the R13 process, could we partner with one of the major medical journals such as JAMA? In terms of getting something published that they might be interested in, we have to discuss this in committee, but you've given me some very good ideas, and I think we just need to follow up on it.
You did an excellent presentation. I want to commend your working group. They put in a lot of time and effort, and that was very, very evident.
Well, thank you, and I've got a hell of a committee. So, you know, it's been truly the work of everybody on this committee. I mean, this is everybody's contributed a huge amount, and I really want to thank everybody for what they've done so far. We've got more to do.
Thank you. Gustavo, do you want to move on to your standard operating procedures?
Can we start at 3? Honestly, I have to take a bathroom break.
We can start.
Gustavo, do you need me for a quorum on anything?
No, I don't. The SOP is not something that the committee needs to vote on. I just want to share with you and get your feedback. I mean, it's not a recommendation to the secretary. So I don't think we need a quorum or a vote.
And we should be all set because we're going to continue your working group and my working group. And I have some comments that I want to say about Dr. Levine at the end, and that should wrap it up.
Okay, so let's take a 10-minute break until 3 o'clock. We'll come back, go through the SOP, and then you can take your you can say your final comments. Okay.
Can I just ask a question? It's Donna.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Donna.
I'm trying to get in, but I think I was on mute. Gary, I just wanted to make sure. We had briefly talked about resubmitting an outstanding recommendation that guidelines be developed in accordance with the IOM standards for developing trustworthy clinical practice guidelines. We had talked about that is a standing recommendation, but Secretary Price has certainly never seen it, and it wasn't addressed when it was submitted a year and a half ago. Is that something that we can just ask that it be resubmitted, or would you rather we not do that at this time?
Ultimately, that's Gustavo's call. I'm completely fine with resubmitting it. And I apologize, I did not prepare to do so. So, Gustavo, your call whether or not it needs to be resubmitted or it simply needs, it's already been approved, so it just needs to go to the Secretary's attention.
I mean, we can resubmit it in the memo. If you guys already submitted it when I think it was Secretary Bernal, this is before my time being the DFO, but I would like to get a vote from the members to have their recommendations resubmitted. And then we can I can include it in the memo with the one we drafted yesterday when it goes to the secretary.
Well, I would easily vote to resubmit it since we've already approved it to submit to begin with.
That's fine with me.
Well,
you want to take a formal vote? Gustavo?
Yeah, just for the sake of the minutes, and then.
Okay, Gary, can you word that vote?
Donna, if you would word it, because you've got this particulars, I believe.
Yeah, I will just read what the recommendation said, and then we're basically asking to resubmit it. It says, CIFSAC recommends that disease-specific diagnostic tools be developed and validated in collaboration with disease experts, and also that comprehensive clinical practice guidelines be developed in accordance with the IOM's standards for developing trustworthy clinical practice guidelines.
Okay, Donna, will you be able to send that in writing to Gustavo when we get down here?
It's in our CIFSAC records. It's posted on the website.
Yeah, I can go and grab it from the website.
From 2015, okay. It was submitted to the secretary. There was a two-paragraph rationale. It quoted the IOM report, at least, maybe the P2P as well.
Okay, so still moved?
On the IOM report, I mean, the IOM report made it very clear that that should be considered something that should be done ASAP.
So it's been moved, and I will second it.
Second by Gary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No opposed, so it passes unanimously, Gustavo.
Okay, just have our minute taker record it. So I will submit it with the one you guys came up with yesterday about having a standard ME/CFS update on the agenda.
Correct.
Thank you.
Gary, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Gustavo, what time do you want to come back?
At 3 o'clock, in about 8 minutes.
Okay. All right, we'll be back.
Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
this time, we'll take a few moments break. Please continue to hold. There'll be music until the conference resumes. By the conference call has resumed.
Faith?
Yeah, we all set?
Yeah.
You want to start the SOP?
Yes. Donna, are you on?
She may be dialing in right now. Give me just a moment to open up her line.
Oh, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Donna, we can hear you.
Great.
Courtney's here. Welcome, Courtney. Welcome back.
So this document came about, and I'm sorry, and I'm sending it to our note taker because she just emailed me to send it to her. As you remember, this document came about because you guys wanted some kind of structure as to and structure and things that needed to get done at every meeting in order for the meeting to be successful. So I went around the other committee members, all of the DFOs in OASH, and asked them if they have an SOP. Some told me they didn't. Others told me they did. So I took some of the work that one of the committees here within OASH did in terms of SOP and redrafted and made some changes and added some things specific to CIFSEC. So I'm not sure how to begin this because it's a long document and there are a lot of people, a few people on the line, but do you guys get a chance to read it and comment since I send it? I know, Donna, I sent it to you way ahead of time before anybody else because you seem to be the most interested in this topic. But does anybody have any specific comment? Did they get a chance to read it, look at it?
I read it
this is Faith, and I thought it overall looked good. I was really glad to see things spelled out. Donna, do you want to comment? Did you put a lot of work into this?
Yeah, I just the reason this was brought up, there was a couple of reasons that this was brought up. We've had some changing in DFOs, and some of the information doesn't get communicated from one to the other. And at each meeting, it seems that that public comments, it's been a struggle to get the public comments in advance so that we can all look at them before we start making our decisions, and that's really important. So we wanted that to be spelled out very clearly. There was also an issue with the January meeting where Gustavo did not know that the wording that was used to describe how the meeting should be held was not clear that the community is now accustomed to live streaming when we're all meeting in person. We were all there in Washington, D.C. We all assumed we were going to be live streamed. I think the community assumed we were going to be live streamed, but that didn't happen. So we wanted to make sure that that was also clear in a document like this. And then there were some other things that have been, you know, suggested through the last couple of years since I've been involved, at least, that we thought would make for a better meeting.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So some of those things were not included in the SOP because of funding in this office, a lack of, believe it or not necessarily in this office, but lack of more modern technology to be able to live stream. So we basically have to work with what we have, and, you know, I'm sorry about that, but it's the reality. So if you all turn to page one, there are four bullets. The second one is that stakeholder will be notified of meeting topic at least 2 weeks prior to the deadline for submission of public comments. Go up, Sarita. First page, you see four bullets. The second one. I mean, I think I have been doing that or trying to for the time that I've been the DFO. The second bullet, the public comment processes and in-person meetings shall be between 3 to 5 minutes. We just went to the GSA training, and GSA, we have two competing arguments from the. One lady say, I think 2 minutes is too short, and another person say, I think 5 minutes is too long. So they really left it up to the DFO and the agenda as to how long each individual should speak. I know when Nancy was here, it was 2 minutes, and it went up to 3 minutes. I think 3 minutes is too short, and I think 5 minutes is just about right. However, I will not promise you that public comments will be 5 minutes every time, because I have to work with the agenda and how much time we have. And if we give an hour of public comments, 5 minutes each individual, that would be about 10 to 12 people. And if we give 3 minutes, it would be more people speaking. So that's I just wanted to bring it up to you guys that the time might change. It could be 5, it could be 3, depending on the agenda.
This is Faith. This is Leah Williams. Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Who's ever got, don't forget to turn your phone on mute if you're not speaking, so we don't have any feedback. This is Faith commenting. I actually thought that it worked the best I've seen it work in years today. People weren't rushed. 5 minutes, I thought, worked very well. I also like the new procedures we put in place where the CIPSAC members commented, and then we opened the lines up to the public for them to ask questions. I thought that went exceptionally well. So we got a lot of input from both our own members as well as the listening audience. So I thought it was a win-win for everybody.
Well, my fear, Faith, is that in future meetings, when I send out an announcement on the listserv saying, if you want public comment, send it, or if you want to speak, let me know, or the CIPSAC supports that. It worked like that. It worked because very few people asked to speak. But if we have on the agenda an hour of public comments and we get 50 people requesting to speak and only the ones that make their request first are put in the list, then we will not be able to open the lines and have the public speak at random.
That makes sense, and we will obviously go with your judgment. I like what you wrote. Exactly what you wrote is fine.
This is Courtney Miller from Cimarron. I want to ask a question and make a comment about today's signing up for the meeting to make public comment.
Yeah.
This meeting, people who requested to be signed up, at least this happened with my husband, got a response saying, which of these three things are you going to address?
Okay.
And the three things were not necessarily what he was going to address. And so he didn't know how to answer that. It wasn't made clear that he could comment on whatever
general comments.
And then he did get a slot for today, and I'm sorry, but he's just too ill to make that comment. In fact, he's too ill to be on vacation with us. I want to make sure that people know, unless you're going to make a policy change, that they can address the topic of the agenda, but they can also address whatever they need to.
Yeah.
Given that the meetings are only 6 months apart, there are a lot of issues people want to bring forward and the committee ought to be considering. So I wanted to make sure that's clear in whatever communications are sent out by whoever's hired to do the sign-up and that kind of stuff.
Courtney, the background to that is that when Beth Collins-Sharp, who is also the alternative and my direct supervisor, when we sat down and brainstormed as to how we can make these meetings more accommodating to the public, she said, why don't we start by selecting a date in which individuals ahead of time will know when the meeting will be and put it on the website. And I thought that was a wonderful idea because now we had a date set for December. So when that happened, we published the RFN, the Federal Register notice, that by FACA rules have to be up at least 2 weeks prior to the meeting. Well, we published it in March for this meeting, and I sent via the listserv a link to that RFA. The Federal Register notice said if you want to make comments for the meeting, email the CIFSAC inbox by June 1st. And I didn't get any comments. When I brought this issue to the committee chairs, the working groups, they say, well, fine, let's just then ask for comments around the work that we are doing. But in the past, the first opportunity that it's given to the public is to provide general comments. And that is usually done via the Federal Register notice.
Okay. So in the past, it hasn't been on. You send out the Federal Register notice, but you also send out an email to listeners saying, if you want to make comment on this date, please let us know by a certain date by emailing whatever that email is. So rarely does a patient read a four-page Federal Register notice.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize you have to send it out and you have to post it that way, but a direct email to the same listserv saying, if you want to make comments, please respond by such and such date, you're going to get more than two people wanting to comment. So I think that's part of why it was light today, or this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Donna. I think a simple solution would be just to add a fourth option, and that would be other topics. One of the reasons that we had suggested to you that you ask for specific topics was so that if we had commenters on topic one, you could slot them before that work group was going to be talking, so that work group would have heard those comments before the deliberation. So you wanted to separate
right.
out comments that way. But there should be the fourth category or however many, you know, there should always be an extra category for somebody who wants to just talk on some other general issue.
I agree with Donna. That's an excellent point. This is Faith.
This is Leah Williams. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. So I have made public comments in the past, and it would be really helpful if we knew if it was 3 or 5 minutes specifically, because that's a very different amount of time to prepare something. And I think the last time it was very confusing because it said different numbers in different places. So, and I personally think 3 minutes is enough time.
Okay. So, going forward, what does the committee think? It's either 3 minutes or 5 minutes for the general public. I found at the last meeting that I did, in my first meeting as CFO last January, that 3 minutes was enough, but that most people really took between 4 and 5 before I have to tell them, okay, your time is up.
This is Donna. I think you should say 3 minutes and account for a little leeway because I think patients end up getting, they're sick, they're tired, they're nervous, they don't speak as quickly as they might want to, and we hate to interrupt them, but I think that the goal should be 3 minutes, and that leaves time in case somebody does run over a little bit. And it also gives us a little extra time if we want to ask questions after we added here, and hopefully we'll incorporate as part of the finalized SOP. If everyone else agrees, I'm not sure.
I agree with that, this is Courtney. It's very difficult to make comments in 3 minutes and say something new.
Okay. So we'll stick to 3 minutes, but as the general public hears on, we'll give them a little bit extra time. But not more than 5, because then I have to... You know, I have a hard time putting an agenda together when we have so many things to discuss, and you know, a lot of this the time is being taken by public comments, and the committee is not conducting its business. Stakeholders in attendance at an in-person meeting shall be invited to provide further information. Okay, so moving on to 1A, the agenda development. Simply says, and the agenda will be developed between myself, the chair, or any work group chair. Number two, and stop me if you have any comments. The agenda shall be posted on the TXA website at least a week prior to the meeting. Donna, I know you had an issue with this before, but I cannot do any earlier than a week. People drop.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. A week.
Okay. Federal Register notice.
Can we wait, though? There is something that I had suggested that didn't get included. I'm not really sure why, but it's an issue that we keep bringing up. I think Carol had brought it up yesterday, and that was that we need each agenda should have adequate time for a brief review regarding the status of recommendations made at the prior meeting. Again, I'm from the business world, but the first thing you do when you're getting ready for a meeting is you look at the minutes of the last meeting and see what was it we were supposed to accomplish, did we accomplish it, and can we report back? And if anything's unfinished, you discuss why is it unfinished? Should we do something about it? And we just lose track of things because we don't do that, and I'm not sure why that recommendation did not get incorporated. Gustavo, perhaps you have a good you know, something that you should explain about the government that I don't understand.
I just feel I didn't include that in here. I'm looking at it. I mean, this I put some of your comments almost 3 weeks ago, and I think that one was not included because the agency updates, the ex officios provide updates on their agency activities, and some of the recommendations usually are tied to an agency. Not usually. Most of the recommendations are tied to a HHS agency. For example, I think Beth Unger gave an update on their on the work that they have been doing with the Department of Education, which was one of the recommendations you guys gave last year, I mean, at the last meeting. So why build something into the agenda that it's already going to be addressed by the ex officials?
Well, if your concern is that we shouldn't put it early in the agenda, perhaps it can be, you know, after all of the reports have been given, we then can say, okay, you know, we recommended this, we're thrilled, this is what the CAC is doing. You recommended this other thing, like the thing I brought up with you about we made an informal recommendation last time, which nothing's happened on that. We should be aware of that and figure out, you know, what are we going to do about it? Do we need to address it?
Well, nothing happened on that specific recommendation because you guys didn't vote on it.
No.
Remember, it was tabled.
That suggested specifically that we don't need to do a recommendation for it, that it's something that you guys could work on. It doesn't have to go to the secretary. That was how we ended that whole situation.
Yeah, but that's also tied. Remember, that's also tied in. My recollection is that Beth said we will also bring this issue up to the ASH.
Yes.
And that's also tied into the fact that we still don't have a permanent ASH.
Right, and all I'm saying to you is I brought that up, but I think that should be part of the agenda. I mean, if it's not, then I'm going to bring them up anyway, but other, you know, members may not do that. I think it's important to follow up on what was supposed to happen, and now we know why it didn't happen, but at least we just haven't ignored it completely.
I agree. This is Courtney.
Yeah. Go ahead, Courtney.
I just wanted to say I agree with Donna. We ought to restate the recommendations and learn if something's happened on them. And if we don't have an Assistant Secretary of Health, we need to push for one. Can't stop doing what we need to do because the administration hasn't moved on it.
So what are you asking is that you want at every meeting before starting, we go through the all recommendations so you guys, so we can give you an update as to where we stand.
Well, I think, Gustavo, I just want everyone to know that you've been doing an excellent job. I think you're fantastic, very responsive, right on top of things. So I'm not trying to criticize in any way.
No. Believe me, this is not personal. This is not my life. My life starts when I leave work.
Okay. So... So this is just the way I'm accustomed to doing things. If I was the DFO, you know, in the past I've been the manager, I would look at the last meetings and I would see, oh, Donna Pearson said she was going to do this. So-and-so was supposed to do that. And I would get an update on those things. So at the last meeting, the minutes say Dr. Colin Sharp said that she and CDRU, actually, will use the recommendation as an example for the new permanent ASH, and it also says that you will work with the ex officios on how to implement the proposed recommendation. So those are two things that didn't happen, and I understand why they didn't happen, but I just don't want them to get lost.
Okay.
You should know that that's why they didn't happen. They're still pending. And I'll also mention one other thing that Nancy Lee had done, but then it never got continued. The CISAC had decided to create a list of all outstanding recommendations.
Yeah.
That's not yet been addressed, and they created it, I think it was maybe in 2013 or something, and then it was supposed to get updated each year, and then that never happened. So this is just a simpler way of trying to just keep track of what's still outstanding.
So in revisiting the recommendations, doesn't the response that the agency provide as to whether or not it can be implemented, isn't that enough?
Yes.
Can't Gustavo
just say these recommendations will be addressed in these agency reports and just leave it at that, this one, here's the situation with this. Would that work?
I mean, I'm thinking back, Donna. Let me give you an example. When I first came on board and Nancy was the DFO in 2016, one of the recommendations made by you guys was to create centers of excellence, and that was addressed primarily at NIH. And I think Vicky at that meeting said that it was very unlikely because of funding that NIH was going to do that. So if we get a recommendation like that in the future, what kind of update would you want to hear from NIH when the response was this will not be done because NIH doesn't have the money?
I wouldn't want an update. I would want that answer, which we would have already gotten. That it would not be a pending issue.
But that answer is on the CEPSA website, on the recommendations. The agency response are always there.
Right, and that is not something. Again, that is not something that would be a pending issue, other than the fact that we did ask her if she could explain the difference between them at the last meeting, and she did that to everyone's satisfaction. So now that's a closed issue. But there were some recommendations made, and there was no response to them. None of the agencies stepped forward and said, yes, I'll do it, or no, I'll do it. They didn't say anything that responded.
And so, this goes back to when?
Well, I could go back through, you know, the last several years and point a couple out to you.
Because my understanding from Nancy was that she was the one who implemented an agency response because of that very same reason. Recommendations will be made, and you will never hear from the committee members will never hear from the government as to what happened to those recommendations.
Yeah, I'm not being very clear. I'm asking for us internally among ourselves to bring up anything that we've noticed that is a pending issue so that we don't lose track of it. That's all I'm asking. That there be time for that, that's all.
Okay, so I will put under C on the meeting logistics that we will revisit the recommendations from the last meeting and provide an update by the ex officio. Moving forward under the Federal Register notice, number one, we will announce the meeting is either in person or webcast. Going back to live streaming, we try to, and Serena, I might have to help me on this one, we found out here within the department if we could do live streaming, and the capability that we have does not allow it. I know in the past it was done. It wasn't done in the past. I think it was film.
And no, it was live. And it was live every in-person meeting.
And this is a question for Sarita. Didn't the people here in the building told you they don't do that?
The live streaming?
Yeah.
That's what I was told, but...
Yeah. I mean, Sarita did her homework here in within the department, and she was told that they don't do that.
If Sarita, if you go back and look in the CIFSEC records, you'll see many live-streamed meetings in that room number 800, which we're going to meet at in December.
Yes.
Once it was down on the first floor, that was live-streamed. And it all came out of advocates getting together and fighting this, and Wanda Jones ultimately saying, yes, we agree this is something that we should do for this particular patient community. So there are cognitive issues, and they are not able to attend. Many of them certainly can't attend.
Wanda Jones is back in OASH. She was detailed to another office. I personally will go see her and find out how did she manage to do it.
Oh, cool. And Nancy Lee did it always, too.
I cannot talk to Nancy for a year.
Oh,
by,
yeah.
By federal law, we cannot talk to her for a year.
Wow, okay.
And you see, we also have a bureaucratic system here that you guys don't know about, but we have to abide by certain rules. So number B2, the Federal Register shall include a request for public comments to be submitted to the CIFSEC mailbox by a given deadline. That's been done.
Yeah.
On top of including a deadline, four, on the Federal Register notice, I will instruct the support team to send out an email saying, we want your comments by this deadline. General comments, not necessarily comments related to any work group. I think B3 is a given. C1 meeting logistics. So we are posting, and this is an idea of Beth Colling Short, which I think is wonderful. 6 months in advance, we'll be selecting the date of the meeting. I have been sending you the public comments, C2, Donna?
Absolutely, that's great. We have time to read them that way.
Yes, that's been excellent. Because then we've been able to comment specifically to the, we've been able to respond to the comments. I thought it was wonderful because I could change my comments based on what they said. Thank you, Austin.
C3, I will find out from Wanda Jones how we can do live stream.
I don't know what they're
doing. One thing that I want to implement here is C4, and this is directly from another committee here within OASH. I'm a tree hugger, and I hate to print too many papers and create more garbage. They give, this specific committee, they give a thumb drive with all the presentations and all the documents needed to their members when they have an in-public meeting, an in-person meeting. So that would require that you guys bring your computer.
I'm fine with that. I don't need the paper.
I'm okay too.
This is Sarita. That would also require that deadline for presentations and any other material be sent, prior or on that deadline, so that the thumb drive could be have all the proper material.
That's fine. I'll try as chair to see if I can push that.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Sarita.
C5 is a given. It's just reminding people to say their name. C6, we don't need to discuss that. Seven is very housekeeping. C8, I know you guys like having the meeting here in room 800. We kind of learned that in order to get that room, we need to make a reservation way in advance. I mean, we already have that room for December. Sarita made those, reserve the room. Why? Was it in January?
It's January.
So a year ahead. What happened at the last meeting was that I didn't think it was so difficult to get that room, and we ended up figuring out that it wasn't available. Moving on to one. Basically says that a week prior to the meeting, all the materials will be provided to the members. And if it is an in-person meeting, a drive will be provided when you guys arrive.
Gustavo, can I interject? I had suggested that it also include the draft recommendations that we will be discussing, and that didn't get incorporated in there. Is there a specific reason?
Probably because of the same reason I told you last time, that the ex officio provide updates, but because now this is going to be a standing agenda item to discuss the previous meeting recommendation, then I will add it on.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that if Gary's group is going to bring a recommendation to this committee for voting, include that in our package 1 week prior so we have time to review it.
Well, that's usually at the end of each presentation, Donna. Faith have recommendations at the end of her presentation.
Right, and what I'm suggesting is if they're going to make a recommendation, shouldn't we know what they're going to be recommending so that if we had any research we needed to do in advance or whatever?
Yeah, and if I send you the presentations a week before or as I receive them, those recommendations would be at the end of the presentations from each work group chair. Are we talking about the same thing?
Yeah, we are. I didn't know that it said, presentations outlined in C2. So let me go in C2. If C2 includes workgroup chairs, we're all set. I don't know. I don't think it says it.
So what's the, are you confused about D1?
So I'm confused about D1. Maybe you're talking about slide decks. Are the slides?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. All meeting materials, slide deck, ex officio, other reports, background documents, public comments, and presentations.
All right, then that's fine.
Yeah, they presentations, slide decks.
It wasn't clear to me. That's okay.
Slide decks and presentations are the same thing. Okay, so let's get rid of slide deck because that's confusing, and then just call it presentation. So what I'm talking about is sending to you guys a week prior to the meeting presentations from working groups.
Yes, that's what I want.
And the work group usually at the end includes their recommendation. Now, whether or not you guys change it when it comes to discussion to the entire committee, that's another matter. D2 has to do with people who don't provide presentations on time. We're just going to have to add it to the USB drive. That might be a pain, but there's no other way. Materials and folder when in the USB will be numbered by tech or foundation. This is all internal. Public comments, E1. E1 says, I will make the determination whether or not public comments will be 5 or 3 minutes, but we agree it should be 3 minutes. For in-person meetings, E3, public comments can be provided by in-person attendees or those on the phone. For teleconference meeting, public comments will be provided, blah, blah, blah. E5, what else? Moving on to F, work groups. We agreed last year at the last meeting, and it worked, and every work group we have an ex-official meeting, an ex-official member, and most likely a member of the agency, which will most likely be affected by the recommendation. Right?
Right.
And if we have any new work group, in order to receive volunteers from the community, we would send that via the listserv. I think we did that at the last meeting with the medical work group. Moving on to 2A, I think you guys can read all of these for yourself, but these are very standard.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry?
This is Debbie Eby.
Mm-hmm.
The arrangement is that 2 weeks after the meeting, the minutes are forwarded.
Okay. So we change that a week to 2 for number B, Debbie, right?
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
And this is where I incorporated the minutes being reviewed by the chair.
So I think the way it's worked in the past is the minutes are published after they've been reviewed by the DFO and the chair.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're not authorized by the committee until the next meeting. And that's a question for you to find out, you know, if that is required or not. It certainly is common with Robert's rules, but I don't know if it is required for SACA.
I'll find out from our committee management officer, and from other committees as to how they do it. But I know FACA rule says that the committee has to be up within a week, but I don't think it says it's clear or even says if they have to be approved by the entire committee. I think, if I remember from the training that I took online, I can go back through my notes, is that it has to be approved by the DFO and the chair. But I will confirm that, and if that's the case, then we'll change it to have the committee approve the minutes at the beginning, from the last meeting, at the beginning of each meeting.
And if that's the case, you would want to remind the members to review those minutes before the meeting. That was done sometimes in the past, but not always.
Okay. D, pretty straightforward as well. Prior to the next IFSAC meeting, the DFO will provide committee members with a copy of the minutes from the last minute for review. At the meeting, the chair will request any additional comments or changes. If the committee is satisfied with the minutes, a vote for approval will be taken. Here you go.
Did you get this from another DFO?
Yes. This is how.
Yeah.
The revised minute will be posted to the CISAC website in place of the previous chair approved minutes. Okay, so here it is.
That's how it's been done in the past, too, and I did. I forgot it was in there, too. It was already there.
And then the rest is internal stuff that we have to do, sending the recommendations to the ASH and having the agency respond to each of the recommendations.
Gustavo, can you clarify for this committee, because it's changed. It changed with two secretaries ago, I think. It used to be that our recommendations went straight to the secretary, and then they got distributed out to the agencies for a response. I think it was Secretary Burwell, maybe. I'm not sure. Who said, I don't even want to see the recommendations until I already have the responses. So is it you that has to get these responses, or is it the ASH, or who is it?
I do. I mean, the ASH doesn't do much, just probably read the memo and sign it or make changes and send it back for changes. But I'm the one who has the DFO, meaning
so
myself or Nancy before. We have to share the recommendations with the agencies and get a response from them and include that in the memo we send forward to the ASH to send to the secretary.
So do you think that's something a future DFO would just know, or do you think you should just be a little bit more clear about that here?
I can include a language that says the DFO have to get the recommendations from the ex officio. I mean, the response.
Doesn't B say that?
The letter is signed by Risa on the period of the check and must include the agency response affected by the recommendation.
It says it. It doesn't say who does it, though.
It says that, yeah, but Don is right. It doesn't say who will do it. Okay. I'm making myself a note.
Can I ask one other request when you're asking about the live streaming?
Yes.
Can you also find out if there's, and I know you, I think you've done some research on this, but I know a lot of people do not like not being able to hear the webinar through their computer, but rather having to use up hours on their cell phone or whatever. And a lot of other webinars, they just have it through the computer. Is it because you have so many people that are talking that are not in the same room? Or I guess the question is there a way to do it so that it's all from the computer, not including those of us who are participating in the meeting, but for the benefit of those who are just listening in?
And this is Faith. I want to echo that. What happened yesterday is I must have gotten kicked off at least 7 to 8 times. So every time I got kicked off from my phone, I had to redial back in, and that was a nightmare because it took 5-8 minutes. So I missed. That's why I ended up missing the whole discussion on my working group. So if there's a way to do it through the computer, that would be really nice.
Well, the issue with that also is that a lot of people don't either have old computers or they don't have speakers. So a suggestion that I send out via the listserv was if you have a Google account, you can access a meeting through Google and then listen through your computer if you have a speaker built in.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I just talked to Nicole. There's some type of MOU that's with the HHS Studio that may do the live streaming.
Yeah, and to do that, we have to work with Jen.
Jen and the media group. So I'll work with Candace and see if we can get it done for December.
Okay. We have a studio here, Sarita was telling me, in HHS. It's called HHS Studio. And that, it appears, and that's what they have used in the past.
We're going to see if that's what they used in the past as opposed to just the meeting space IT group. There's an actual live studio here that they use for secretary, you know. So I'm going to contact them and see if we can start working that avenue for December, and hopefully we can get the live streaming going.
That would be great, Sarita. That would make life much easier.
But when we have a webinar, I think we are somewhat limited to what we have, I mean, to what we use today. Unfortunately, Sarita and I, she tried to find out, as she's more technological than I am, as to how we can do this better. And she called Verizon, and the contract that the department has with Verizon does not allow this people to be able to hear and speak through the computer at the same time.
Okay.
We're not ignoring your requests. We're just limited by what the government has to offer.
No, we appreciate you looking into it. That's really nice of you.
So I will.
This is Ben.
Yes, sir.
Sorry, I was just going to say, echoing that, I too have been on the other side of the table with this thing, trying to put together public input sessions and meetings on the state government level, and I appreciate how difficult and challenging some of the technical aspects can be. I wonder if, in addition to this, you know, we can, ME Action can continue to look how we can maybe continue to disseminate and pass out some of the information that you have to provide through very strict and legal channels in some more plain language. For people, for patients, particularly in the patient community, so they could access this more easily.
Yeah, we'll definitely feel free, Ben. Are you on the listserv for SIGSEC?
Yes.
I mean, feel free that anything that goes out on the listserv to send it out through your media channels at ME Action.
We will do that, and I'm just saying I'll probably also follow up with you later just to clarify, make sure that we understand to the best possible extent all the things and when they will come out so that we can communicate them more effectively to our community. So thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you, and I appreciate your help. Anything else regarding the SOP?
Thank you so much for doing that.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Gustavo.
I'm going to put these on the website. I don't know where yet. But once they are finalized, we're going to put it up. We're also working with Q&A, but that's proven to be a little bit more challenging. I know I sent out an email a month ago via the listserv asking for questions. And a lot of the questions I received were not necessarily related to what we were asking. We were asking about things about the committee and how it works. And a lot of the response I received from the community was more medical. And so So.
So I will. This is Donna. I will volunteer to help with that. I think I have an understanding of the many misunderstandings about the committee at this point. So I'll help you with that.
Well, the Q's and A are final. I collected all the questions, you know, disregard the ones that were not really addressing what we were asking, which is, you know, how is a chair elected? You know, how many members are on the committee? Those are the kind of things that I want to post on the website so people will know, instead of emailing the TIFSAC inbox and, you know, and then having the supporting reply to every single email. So I thought Beth and I sat down and said, let's do some Q's and A's. So when I sent out an email, I'm not sure how many of you saw it, a lot of the questions I got back was, why isn't my doctor diagnosing me, or where can I find a doctor in Oregon? You know, that's not what we asked. So the questions that we did receive, we answered them, but now we have to put into clearance within this office before we put it up on the website. If there are not any more comments regarding the SOP, Faith, we put up your on the webinar.
Does anybody have any final comments before I go?
Yes. So I wanted to comment. This is Courtney Miller from Cimarron. On a couple of things not directly related to the SOP. Do we have a moment to do that?
Yes, you do. Go ahead, Courtney.
Okay. It is sort of related to the functioning of CISPAC. I would like to see the federal agencies ask CISPAC for review or input or recommendations on particular things they want to implement. I think NIH did that once, maybe it was 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, I don't remember, and we set up a working group on how to get public patient and community input into a more systematic method for that. And I think once HHS was asked for the committee to, it would be 2 years ago, to provide some recommendations related to the IOM report. But to make this more of a two-way use of the expertise on this committee, I'm wondering if there's a way we can get different agencies to pose a particular, you know, give us input on this. We want to find a way to do this and have that be something this body participates in.
This is Faith. That's a very interesting idea. That goes along with my idea of, I don't want us to be making recommendations that they cannot possibly implement. So the same thing as you, to make it more of a two-way street where we're working together to move the ball forward on what to accomplish. That's a really good question, and I don't think that question's ever been asked. Can the ex officios recommend?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that was part that we discussed at the last meeting, that at every meeting, an ex-officio will be at that working group to advise the working group on whether or not the recommendations will be doable or not.
And that's for recommendations that we make or that the body, CISPAC, makes. So if there's active programs happening in these agencies related to our disease, and there should be, they could be asking us for the formal CISPAC board, what is your recommendation about such and such? What should we do with this program? How can we make this work for ME-CFS. So right now there's mostly a one-way FIFSAC makes recommendations. The working groups are trying to make them deep and make the argument for them and have the ex officio in the working group. But only on occasion has an agency come to CIPSAC and said, okay, we have this idea. We want your help in defining it or recommending it or making it work. So I'd like to see more of that.
I don't know what to say, and I will turn it over to the ex officio. Is there any on the line still?
this is Beth. I'm on the line, and I that is the way advisory committees are supposed to work. They're supposed to respond in to specific questions, and that is not the way the committee has been working, and so that's an interesting and important suggestion.
You're saying that we're not doing it right, Beth?
I don't mean that, but I just mean, for example, the other advisory committee that I work with is the ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They have a very different kind of role, but they have they are asked very, very specific questions, and they need to answer them. Whereas, as been pointed out, this committee has not been presented with very pointed, specific questions. So it does a different thing. And I think originally, I mean, this came out of a need to try to coordinate the government response to, I mean, there was, I guess, in the beginning of time, a committee just of the ex officios, and then it kind of evolved into this committee. I think everybody has been trying to figure the way to make it most effective, because I think that there has been some dissatisfaction both in the community, you know, and just in general. So I don't mean to say that it's wrong, but, you know, I just think it is a good idea to think of how to make it more effective.
So, Beth, say that a little bit. Say that again. How do the other committees work?
Well, they actually respond to, you know, should this vaccine be approved or not, and how should it be approved, and they are charged with making specific recommendations or answering specific questions. And that is, most advisory committees are constituted to answer questions, to provide specific advice. And that's exactly what Courtney has suggested, that the committee, you know, there should be questions that the committee is responding to.
And where do those questions come from?
Well, she's right. It comes from the government. This is or HHS. HHS, this is a committee to HHS. So HHS or the HHS agency should be the ones providing questions.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of that.
So does the DFO then approach each agency beforehand? And yeah, I mean, I think Nancy Lee solicited questions from HHS for that meeting that Courtney brought up. There were four questions that we were asked. And I know that Vicki just, I think, off the top of her head had made a suggestion at one time, but I'm certainly in favor of this.
I was going to say I would be fine with it.
And sorry, I have to step away from my computer because it ran out of battery, and I have to go get my cable. So what were you guys saying?
So we'd like to see the agencies who are represented on CISAC, either via you or HHS or directly the ex officios, come to CISAC with not every agency, every meeting, but we have this program or challenge or desire to do something related to ME/CFS. We want your recommendations on how to make that the most effective effort. So that there's two-way recommendations, and essentially,
well,
we make recommendations.
I think I understand what you say now, but I cannot go to the agency. They have to come to me because I don't know every single program in every of the agencies.
That's right. They should come to you, or
they should come.
Yeah.
For example, I'm going to throw it out there because it's an agency that I know well because I used to work there. Joel Nursen from HRSA finds out that they're funding something around ME/CFS, some kind of program, and he should come to me and say, can we bring this up to the committee and provide recommendations, for example. I couldn't know what every single agency on the committee is doing for. I could ask them on my monthly meeting, do you guys have any program that is likely going to be funded dealing with ME/CFS? But otherwise, they would have to come to me. I cannot go to them.
Well, it would help if you prompt it in those meetings. I do think it's got to be substantive, and it's going to, you know, there are more agencies who could be coming in with more proactive programs and things that need our, could benefit from our input or recommendations.
We also have a committee here in the Office of Women's Health. It's called Committee on Women's Working Group. Anyway,
Coordinating Committee for Women's Health.
For Women's Health, and it's basically all the HHS agencies, including the U.S., the VA. And who else on there, Sarita? But I think the VA is the only non-HHS agency. Anyway, they come together every month and they provide a number of presentation on activity affecting women. I know this is a condition that not only affects women, but the chair of that committee, I could ask her to make an announcement and find out if they're doing anything around ME/CFS.
Yes, and how can they ask us what they could be doing around ME/CFS?
So, but to be honest and to keep it real with you guys, if there was something being at CDC around ME/CFS, I am sure that Beth Ongo would know outside her scope of what she already knows. Same thing for the HARQ. But like you say, Courtney, it would be worth at least just asking.
What NIH did, right? They were implementing a whole new program, and they came to the CISVAC and said, give us a model for how to have patient and community engagement as we move forward, right? And we spent a work group and a bunch of time coming up with recommendations.
Okay, well, I have monthly meeting with the ex officio, so we can. I will ask them at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any other comments?
No, I think we can move on with your final closing remarks and. Until the next time, but I'm sure there's much work to do between now and December.
That sounds good. All right. Let me thank my start by thanking the members that were here today and yesterday, Sue, myself, Jane, Gary, and Donna. Everybody put in a lot of work in our working group, as well as two thank you members. The ex officios, Beth Unger, Janet Maynard, Joel Nelson, Michelle Schaefer, Vicki, and Drew. We appreciate all the work that you put in and the time that you put in and what you've done the last 6 months since we've met. These PowerPoints were very clear. The presentations were well done. I'd like to also welcome and thank the new non-voting liaison members, Leah, Courtney, and Ben. I think you added a lot to the last 2 days. And lastly, Gustavo and Sarita, for all of your work and your time that you've put in. We very much appreciated it. And then I've got a final comment for Dr. Levine. I don't know if she's on, but I wanted to, and it should be up on the whiteboard, I wanted to take a moment and thank Dr. Levine, not for her, only for her work over her past year as chair of this committee, but also her lifelong commitment as a clinical researcher, a compassionate physician, and a dedicated colleague and an awesome mom. From my own personal perspective, I'm quite aware that without Sue Levine, my son Michael would not be a rising college senior next year. He got ME/CFS when he was in fourth grade. He had never been to school full-time until he got to college. I can say this for all parents and children and other patients that she has helped either directly through her office or indirectly by consulting with other physicians. She is just unbelievable with her time. As SysVac chair, she's given her time, her wisdom, and her patience in ways that people hearing me now may not have ever had the opportunity to witness. She took the chair's position as a positive advocate and a role model quite seriously. She's never failed in good humor, even when the demands associated with the position ate into her time for research or her time with her patients. We've been exceptionally fortunate to have Dr. Levine as chair, and I can only hope to emulate her example, but it's going to be quite a challenge. Thank you again, Sue, for everything. Rita, can you scroll down just a little bit more on that screen?
I sure can.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Faith, did you want your contact information there?
Yes, I did. That's exactly what I was hoping you to put up there, the contact information and the primer information. A couple of people asked for it, and it was the easiest way to put it there.
Gotcha.
There is, I'll put up there my contact information, which is Dr. Faith Newton, which is fnewton@desu.edu. There's also the primer link for the ME/CFS diagnosis and management in young people, a primer. Several of you asked about that. That link you can either get from me or Sarita will put it up. It's the Journal and Frontiers in Pediatrics that just came out the 19th of June. That was done by an international working group. It has phenomenal information in it for both parents and for clinicians and practitioners. Again, thank you for your time. This meeting is adjourned, and I thank all of you for the last 2 days, and especially those of you in the government for your time.
Thank you, Faith. If you like, we could put your public email on this SysVac website, but do realize that a number of people, you will get probably lots of emails.
That's fine. I'm used to it. Just add it. If they want to contact me, I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. I think you have to call a motion to end the meeting.
Oh, that's right. Can we have a motion to adjourn?
Can somebody second?
Donna, somebody?
Dane, second.
Oh, good. Thanks, Dane. Everyone in favor, say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? All right. We are adjourned.